using free speech to free minds. You're listening to The David Knight Show.
As the clock strikes 13 on this Thursday, the 15th of April, year of our Lord 2021, it is day 397. 397 days of America held hostage. Today we're going to have as our guest Artur Perlowski, who is the Polish pastor that you saw on Easter, running the police out of his church. Get out. And that is the appropriate response, but I think you're going to find his life story to be very interesting. Stay with us. We have many things to talk about. We'll tell you on the other side of the music break. As I said, we're going to have a very interesting interview, I think, with a pastor who has been in the fight for free speech for 15 years in Canada. His experiences have been kind of a microcosm of what the church is experiencing everywhere in the West right now. We'll also be talking about the specifics of the Supreme Court hacking plan that has now been unleashed. But I want to begin by talking about Sam Montoya, an InfoWars reporter, who was arrested in a big raid. Had a lot of FBI agents show up, knock down his door, arrested him, because he was filming inside the Capitol on January the 6th. Now, Sam is not a guy who would ever get violent with anybody. He wasn't anybody that I knew particularly as even being political. He's a really nice guy, really nice guy. I really hate to see this happen to him. He was not political. He was not a reporter. He was basically a cameraman, editor. He was there in that capacity. And as I've said to Karen many times, it's a good thing I wasn't there, because if I was there and saw something like that happening, if you're going to be in news, right, you don't run away to the other side of town when something like that happens. You go to it. In the same way that when you have an emergency and you have firemen or policemen, they run toward the disaster. That's what a journalist does, to record it, to do what they do. You don't run away. And so that's what Sam did. And the pictures that they've got here showing him, he's got a camera up to his shoulder. He's standing there between velvet ropes filming. As I've said many times, a lot of people have been caught up in this, who were let in. Even a Huffington Post journalist, Ryan Riley, said the idea that every journalist who covered the event was somehow obligated to have a congressional press pass, and that was what they put in the indictment. We looked his name up, and we didn't see his name as being somebody who was permitted to cover what's going on. Let me tell you something. We have a lot of states that have recognized constitutional carry, because that's what the Constitution says. And we don't need to have a permit. We do it simply because we want to try to live peaceably with other people. So we will comply with your regulations up to a point. Up to a point. Sometimes we shouldn't, because sometimes that just encourages these people. Like feeding the monster. Oh yeah, they did that. Let me add another rule. See if they'll do that one too. But when it comes to free speech and a free press and the right to public assembly and the right to the free exercise of religion, we don't need permission from you. We don't need permission to meet for Easter Sunday or any Sunday. We don't need your permission to cover a riot. And you have no right to shut us down if we are not doing anything wrong. If we're simply observing and recording, of course, that's a threat to you, isn't it? So Ryan Riley put it out. He said, seriously? They confirmed that no one by that name has a congressional press credentials as an individual via any other organization. And when you look at the indictment, there's something very troubling about it. Because what it says is that if you knowingly enter or remain in a restricted building or grounds without lawful authority to do so, knowingly and with intent to impede or disrupt the orderly conduct of government business or official functions, and they say a restricted building includes a posted or cordoned off or otherwise restricted area of a building or grounds where the president or other person protected by the Secret Service, including the vice president, is or will be temporarily visiting. So there's this kind of bubble that is everywhere, right? But wouldn't you think that incumbent upon that would also be the requirement that the people who are protecting this individual who is so sacred? You know, there was once upon a time it wasn't necessary to have a cordon of armed men to cover our politicians. During the Civil War, there was a British officer, Arthur Fremantle, of the Coldstream Guards. He wrote a book called 3 Months in the Southern States. And one of the most interesting things about that book was the fact that in the middle of a civil war, he was able to enter via Texas and go up and meet Sam Houston and meet Robert E. Lee and meet all these different people of both of the forces. Wasn't cordoned off from that. He could go in and talk to anybody. Went in and talked to presidents. And this is a new thing that we have, the security state, the paranoid security state that demands that you have no means whatsoever to protect yourself, but they cordon themselves off. The same thing they're doing with information as well now. They must know everything about you. You're not allowed to know anything about them. At no point in the indictment is Sam Montoya accused of attacking the police or committing any acts of violence. The main evidence against him is that he allegedly made a few comments during a 44-minute video that were critical of the government. Because, you see, that's the real crime today. To be an American dissident, that's where we are today. That's one of the reasons we're going to be talking to the Polish street preacher, Arthur Pawlowski. Judging by the Fed's out-of-context transcriptions, and this is an article by Chris Minahan, Information Liberation. He's got a very good coverage of this. Judging by the Fed's out-of-context transcriptions, it appears he wasn't even in the Capitol building until the 12:55 mark, and he was making statements encouraging everybody to be orderly and civil. We don't hurt innocent people. We don't tear down statues. We don't tear down statues. We take our house back. We take the people's house back. Ah, see, that's a threat. Why is it a threat to say that it's the people's house? I mean, Nancy Pelosi says that all the time, right? All these politicians, this is the people's house. They don't believe it's the people's house. It's their own personal shrine. When they say it's the people's house, it's a cynical lie. When you say it, they view it as a threat because they see themselves in 100% control. Some of the other things he said was, here we are in the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C., in the Capitol building. It's officially been stormed by Trump supporters. Again, the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C. has officially been stormed by Trump supporters. Here we are taking the people's house back. So it sounds like a real criminal, doesn't it? Because, see, journalism has been criminalized in the U.S. The indictment even included the photo of him walking respectfully within the velvet ropes. And as Chris Minahan said, the charges against him read like a sick joke. It is a sick government. This government has become a joke. Become a Stalin joke. The overwhelming majority of the folks who entered the Capitol just walked right past the police who told them they disagree with him entering the building, but they respect, quote-unquote, their right to protest. They stood aside. They invited them. Well, we don't agree with you going in, but we respect your right to protest. And contrast that, as Chris Minahan does, to the efforts that they have gone through to track down each and every person in there and then to conduct FBI raids on them. Contrast that to what they did with a BLM lawyer couple of lawyers who threw a Molotov cocktail at a police cruiser. None of the elaborate measures taken to hunt down every last person who stepped foot in the Capitol were used to hunt down the violent Black Lives Matter rioters who have caused $2 billion in damages last year and are now rioting again in Minnesota night after night. This is what we see. And, of course, there have been situations where there was much more of an attack against the Capitol building under Marxists like Bill Ayers, who then went on to be at the epicenter of the Marxist attacks to burn down the rest of our country. Meanwhile, as they're coming after Sam for filming what was there, and maybe this is one of the issues, because, you know, if you have people who were filming it and they film cold-blooded murder of somebody who is a protester, like Ashley Babbitt, they don't want to bring any charges against that. As a matter of fact, I fully expect that this individual, who has not been named, will probably get a medal, like Lon Horiuchi, who shot Randy Weaver's wife point-blank in the head while she was holding a baby. And I say point-blank, he was a sniper, a trained sniper, at the range that he was at with the equipment that he had, his ability, his marksmanship, it was point-blank. Cold-blooded murder, and that's what happened with Ashley Babbitt. Federal prosecutors have now dropped the case. It was expected, but it's still wrong. Still wrong. Is the Department of Justice lying about the Ashley Babbitt case? Story at Zero Hedge. Well, as they said, as members of the mob continued to strike the glass doors, Ms. Babbitt attempted to climb through one of the doors where the glass was broken out. An officer inside the speaker's lobby fired one round from his service pistol, striking Ms. Babbitt in the left shoulder, causing her to fall back from the doorway onto the floor, subsequently died. There is no mention, notice, of a verbal warning. When we have excessive force used, as I pointed out about the Dante Wright shooting, it was unreasonable, and even if the person was panicked, it wasn't premeditated. There's different levels of murder, right? Premeditated murder and other things. If you just manslaughter charges that they brought against an officer, it's the same sort of thing that would happen. If you recklessly, carelessly drove your car, negligently, whatever, and injured somebody. You know, when you have something like a car or you're a trained officer with a gun, you're supposed to know how to use it. And that also applies to this guy who killed Ashley Babbitt. Without firing a warning shot, without giving a verbal warning, just executed her. And so as they point out in the indictment, they say prosecutors would have to prove, or the lack of an indictment, I should say, a statement. Prosecutors would have to prove not only that the officer used force that was constitutionally unreasonable, but that the officer did so willfully, which means that the, according to the Supreme Court, the way they've interpreted that, is that the officer acted with a bad purpose to disregard the law. Well, they said excessive force is very easy to establish. It was certainly excessive in relation to the legitimate objective here of getting people back. Again, verbal warning, a warning shot, firing a gun in a way that was less lethal if you had to do that. All of that would be indicated here. They didn't even address that, though. They skipped over the excessive force. They went straight to the willfulness with the Department of Justice communication. They said that they brought to bear Section 242 prosecutions, and they said, well, this doesn't meet that test. As the article on Zero Hedge points out, these Section 242 prosecutions have been brought with the Department of Justice with far less egregious facts. As the Department of Justice has argued, in other cases, the officer's prior training on the use of force could be viewed as, quote, evidence that conduct was willful. In another case, the Department of Justice argued to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals that to establish willfulness, The jury was required to find that the defendant intended to use more force than was reasonable under the circumstances. In other words, force that violated the victim's well-established due rights as a pretrial detainee. So what makes this different? Well, we all know what makes it different. The only thing that makes it different is who it is and the politics of this. The politics of this. We almost had a repeat in Texas yesterday of the blackouts, the rolling blackouts that we had because of the winter storm. Who knew? I mean, this was not, this was very, very mild weather. So mild, as a matter of fact, that they had scheduled these people that we call, and I guess it's become somewhat hypocritical now to call them the Electric Reliability Council of Texas. These people had decided that they would right now, before coming up into the summer, that they would close about half of the grid down for maintenance. And then it turned out that people were using more power than they had anticipated. And the demand on the grid was about 3,000 megawatts higher than they anticipated, about 600,000 homes. As one person, associate professor of environmental engineering at Rice University, said, it's a disgrace for a power grid in modern times to struggle to keep the lights on during a mild day. We will be in trouble when the summer heat wave comes, and the demand is 1.5 times as much as it was yesterday. And again, at the center of this is politics. Our society is breaking because of politics and corruption. It is the central planning of the government. And a lot of people say, well, this is operating according to market forces. No, market forces are not involved when you're spending $5 billion to set up infrastructure specifically for windmills. And when that money is typically going to a handful of now much, much richer billionaires. This is not market forces. This is crony capitalism. This is corruption. This is redirecting resources, breaking something that wasn't a problem. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, we didn't have a broken grid until they fixed it with renewables, and now it is pretty broken. As utilities often schedule repairs for the spring when weather is mild, demand is lower, they added solar and wind generation came in lower than expected again. How about that? Imagine that. I've been talking about this for 15 years, how unreliable solar and wind generation is. But of course, it there's reasons for this that don't have anything to do with power generation. It is about power generation, generating the power for these wealthy people who are taking over and destroying our society for their own selfish advantage. That's what it is. It's about corporate power, crony capitalism power. And as a part of this, the market that they have for auctioning this stuff out, prices soared by 10,000%, went up by a factor of 100. Now, it wasn't as bad as what happened during the winter storm because they put a cap on it. During the winter storm, it had gone from, I think it was like $29 per megawatt hour, up to $9,000. And so they said, well, we're not going to do that again. We're going to put a cap of $2,000. So guess where it went? Peaked out at $2,000, where they had capped them after the previous energy crisis. Bitcoin is not doing quite as well as the electricity on a mild day in Texas, but it's still doing pretty good. It's not going up by 10,000%, but cryptocurrency has gone up by 1,000% in a year, factor of 10. That's kind of interesting as we see that. And of course, what is behind that is a massive move by institutions, especially financial institutions, to go into cryptocurrency. And I think that they're preparing everyone for digital cash. That is going to be a big point of control that we should all be concerned about. And I understand that Bitcoin was designed to get around government regulations. It's going to be something of a perhaps a tough nut for them to crack, but they've shown the will to use any means necessary. Kind of like the ghost gun thing. It's going to be difficult for them to track down ghost guns. And I think even more difficult than it will be for them to stop Bitcoin. But that doesn't mean that they won't do everything that they can. And it doesn't mean that they won't trap a lot of innocent people in this. I mean, we've seen in the past when they were trying to stop marijuana use, they would come after people and SWAT team people who simply had legitimate. There never was any authority for them to have a war on drugs, but they had legitimate hydroponics that they were using. But, you know, if you went to a hydroponic store and you got some stuff because you were setting up gardening and certain supplies, that would put you on the list and you might get a SWAT team raid. As we look at what is happening in the Ukraine and Russia, there are troubling signs that the Russians may be getting ready to invade, as there has been conflict going on there and as the Biden administration has been stoking that conflict. The Ukrainian government reports estimates that the Kremlin will deploy up to 30,000 extra soldiers, accompanied by more tanks and rocket systems, in support of 80,000 Russian troops that are already waiting orders to advance. That's not new. However, there are new satellite images that show the Russians painting stripes on their tanks to identify them, putting like a big white crosses on them from the top so they can identify them. Why did they do that? And they've done this before. They did this before when they invaded Czechoslovakia in 1968 because the Czechs had the same tanks. And the Ukrainian government has now the same equipment that the Russians do. So prior to that invasion in 1968 of Czechoslovakia, they painted invasion stripes, as they call them now, on their tanks so they could distinguish friend from foe. The fact that they're doing this now, close to the border, this is 350 miles from the front. It shows armored personnel carriers as well as tanks painted with broad white stripes and on their way to a railroad station. So this could be an indication that things are escalating. We had last week, and I didn't cover it, we had a letter that was put out by a lot of concerned national security experts. The person's name at the top of the list was William Binney. Also on there, John Kiriakou, two men that I have the utmost respect for, very concerned about what the Biden administration is doing in terms of pushing us into a conflict over a territorial dispute. And I don't really care, frankly, what's going on between the Ukrainians and the and Crimea. I mean, we can make a case that if the Ukraine, the inconsistency of the West in saying that the Ukraine can secede from the Soviet Union, but Crimea can't secede from Ukraine. Either you support secession as a right of self-government or you don't. And all the rest of the stuff in terms of corruption, both of these sides are corrupt as they can be. Both the people that were replaced in the Ukraine, as well as the people who replaced them. There aren't any good guys there, as far as I can tell. So I don't really care about that. There's the hypocrisy about secession that is interesting, I find interesting. But we don't need to be caught up in these kind of foreign entanglements. We should listen to the founders of our country. Speaking of foreign entanglements, and I think there's got to be something else going on here, because this just doesn't seem to match with what Biden has always done. I hope he's sincerely going to pull the troops out of Afghanistan. And not because he wants to get them involved in some kind of a Russian conflict, or because he wants to bring him here to use them against us. I hope he just wants to get rid of a war that has gone on for 20 years. But the person who is absolutely livid about this is Lindsey Graham. So let's listen to Lindsey vent about how he might lose his forever war in Afghanistan.
The result of this decision today by President Biden is to cancel an insurance policy that, in my view, would prevent another 9/11, because I believe with all my heart and soul, after 50-something trips to the region, that a few thousand Americans watching over there would make it hard for al-Qaeda and ISIS to reorganize to hit us over here. Those eyes and ears will be gone. I don't trust the Taliban to look out for American interest, but we're finding ourselves in a very precarious situation.
Either.
Again, there are no great outcomes, but this is the worst possible outcome, is to pull up and leave and hope that things will turn out well. That did not happen in Iraq, and it did not happen here.
Things haven't turned out well for 20
years. The least risky choice is to keep American military personnel with the intelligence community involved in Afghanistan until there's a genuine reconciliation, until the Taliban and the Afghan people can find a way to move forward together. It is not democracy I'm pushing under this concept. It is making sure that the country doesn't become the safe haven it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, there you go. So that's Lindsey Graham. He started out before that. He said, I miss John McCain a lot. Because if John was with us here, I'd be speaking second. He'd be telling you a story about how unwise this decision is to withdraw all of our forces from Afghanistan. Because, you know, it was John McCain who was going from Republican women's clutches, little meetings to another, with a Mujahideen soldier with him, saying, you want to adopt a Muj? Yeah, give us some money for this secret war. And they turned into Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and ISIS. They've rebranded these people. They have these people as a rotating thing. It's the same thing we saw with strongman Manuel Noriega, right? You're a friend of the CIA one day, and the next day, you're public enemy number one. This is how this works. All this stuff about we can wind up with another 9/11. Well, you believe that men in caves learned how to fly these planes lower and faster than the people who had flown them for decades who were instructors about that? Well, you may need to learn to look up the statements by pilots for 9/11 Truth. If you believe that these buildings could fall into their own footprint after a few hours, you need to look at what the architects and engineers from 9/11 Truth are talking about. And if you think that three buildings are going to fall in their footprint after only two of them have been hit, you may be beyond any rational thought whatsoever. So he says, I'm certain our military advised against a unilateral withdrawal. Well, perhaps at this point, we could talk about what the strategy is. We have a plan for winning. Are they winning? Lindsey said, I'm heartbroken. Well, was he heartbroken when he saw the soldiers being killed, maimed, for a cause that Lindsey Graham and his colleagues couldn't even be bothered to define? You want to declare the war? You want to be specific about what the plan is here, Lindsey? He still doesn't have a plan. Well, I just think we ought to stay there and keep an eye on these people forever, you know. And they've said that many times. Liz Cheney was very outspoken when they asked her, when do we get out of Afghanistan? What's the exit plan? When do we declare victory and leave? She said, never, ever. It was never the plan to leave. Never the plan. So I hope that this happens. Trump had a scheduled withdrawal May 1st. I didn't really believe that after he didn't do it for 5 years. Now that Biden has delayed it from May 1st to the 20th anniversary of 9/11, I still am somewhat skeptical that it's going to happen. It should happen. But before it happens again, we should make sure that we have a debate and that we declare the purpose, why we are going to war, what the purpose is, what the objective is, and what does victory look like, and how do we end this thing? We got to get over this idea of permanent wars, and we got to get over politicians like Liz Cheney and Lindsey Graham. We got Biden's UN ambassador is talking about joining the UN's human rights group. Now, who is in the human rights group? We've had organizations like Saudi Arabia, other dictatorships, where they're in a competition to see how many heads they can chop off of their citizens who are political dissidents every year. They've been in charge of this in the past. We have currently in the UN Human Rights Council, we have Pakistan, Somalia, Qatar, Cuba, Venezuela, Sudan, Libya. And yet, as we have this Linda Thomas Greenfield, she's black, and she's saying that, you know, we need to, if America is going to join the UN Human Rights Council, we have to have an acknowledgement of our own failures because white supremacy is weaved into our founding documents and principles. She calls it our original sin. You understand what she's saying here? What she's saying is that it's exactly the opposite of what Thomas Sowell presented in terms of the facts. We did not invent slavery in America. That's what these people are saying. It is not our original sin. It is not original to America. It is still going on. As a matter of fact, in some of these countries that are on the UN Human Rights Council right now, they're actively engaged in slavery. Every civilization has had it. What's unique about our civilization is that we're the first one to try to, that stopped it, and that even tried to stop it in other countries. And that wasn't because of our Declaration of Independence or any of those principles. It was because it was done by Christians, people like William Wilberforce in the UK. Spent his entire life first stopping the slave trade and then stopping the ownership of slaves, doing it against the most entrenched financial interest in his country. And that's why we should never be discouraged about taking on injustice. Look at William Wilberforce, one guy on the side of what's right, with God on his side, because he got on the right side, and look what he was able to do in the UK. And we have to focus on the moral issues. It is a stench to God to have injustice and unequal scales and the rest of this over and over and over and over again. That theme is hammered throughout the Bible, Old and New Testament. How do we look the other way and make accommodation with this? And I got to say, even when I look at some of the things that are happening with this lockdown, some of the churches, we have a politician, I think in Indiana, I'll get to it later, but say offering a bill saying that churches are now to be considered to be essential services. I understand we need to do what we can to pull back on this, but I think we need to be a little bit more direct, and we need to get to the heart of the fire that is burning down our country. And if we start to carve out particular exemptions, then first of all, that's not the path that Christians should be looking for. We need to go to the heart of the issue. We need to defend this for everybody, not just for ourselves. We don't need to cut a deal with these people. That's the thing that bothered me so much about the cynical moves by Greg Abbott at the beginning of this. As they started locking down everything and started applying the rules equally, they shut down church worship. And Greg Abbott realized that was going to be a very unpopular situation with his constituency, so he carved out an exemption for the churches. And that was all that a lot of the pastors needed. Well, that's great. He carved out an exemption for us. Well, and they were pacified by that. They shouldn't have been satisfied by that. They should have, even if they didn't believe that this was going to be used, that this was going to metastasize to come after them once everything got adjusted. They should have defended the rights of other people as well. And I'm not talking about a social gospel. I'm not one of these guys, these you see this happening a lot, the rise of the Marxists and the Jesuits in South America that this Pope comes from. And I'm not a social justice warrior for the church. I don't believe that's the church's primary mission. But let me tell you something. You don't walk away from somebody's needs. And you don't allow injustice and unequal scales to prevail in a country. And that's why we need to fight this thing. That's really the issue that needs to happen. This is not about, again, making it a race-based issue. Facebook has banned your gun ads, but spends millions on Zuckerberg's security. Good article on Breitbart from A.W.R. Hawkins. He's their gun guy. He points out that Facebook bans gun ads, but they spent over $23 million on security for Mark Zuckerberg last year. That was $13.4 million in personal security, plus another $10 million in the form of a pre-tax allowance for his family's private security. And that is a $3 million increase over security costs of the previous year. More than 10% it went up. But of course, you shouldn't have that protection. Bernie Madoff, who made off with everybody's money, died at 82 in a federal prison. And everybody is, it's headline news everywhere. Here's my take on Bernie Madoff. Yeah, he was a crook. I'm surprised that he wasn't pardoned by Trump. He's exactly the kind of person that Trump pardoned. Not Julian Assange. Not people like Ross Ulbricht or Marty Gottesfeld or Schaefer Cox or other people who are political prisoners who never did anything wrong. They are examples. Ross Ulbricht, if he was engaged in the, and I don't know that he was convicted of running Silk Road, but at the same time, it had been taken over by corrupt FBI agents who also went to prison, but the jury was not allowed to know that. And then they railroaded him to make him an example. They alleged, they had allegations, but they never had any indictment even. And you can indict a ham sandwich, literally, with a grand jury, because there is, it's only one side of the case is being presented by the prosecutor, and there's nobody to push back against that at that stage. So you can indict anybody you want. They didn't even bother to try to get an indictment on Ross Ulbricht. They just put out press reports and allegations that he had been involved in murder for hire at a time when the FBI was running the site itself. And these guys were also skimming about $1 million off for themselves. But they were really trying to make an example of anybody who was operating on the dark web, anybody who was using the internet to get around their arbitrary restrictions on whatever. So we had a lot of people like that that could have been pardoned. Typically, the people who were pardoned were the big, big, big financial criminals, friends of Trump's son-in-law. And so these people got off. You have Bernie Madoff. $65 billion he swindled out of thousands of clients. Well, that's pretty big. But it doesn't even compare to Operation Warp Speed. I mean, that was about $60 billion right there. $20 billion the first time, and then they added much more with paying for the manufacturing of these poisons. And it wasn't thousands of people who were swindled. It was hundreds of millions of Americans who were swindled, who had their livelihoods destroyed. We have, and they stopped counting. I haven't seen anybody do an update on the number of businesses that are permanently closed since last fall. Because we don't want to talk about that now that Biden is in office. We don't want to talk about all the businesses that are being killed by this lockdown. But can you imagine if Bernie Madoff had destroyed 100,000-plus businesses and all the people that work for them? Can you imagine if instead of just giving $65 billion to himself to buy shiny new things, if he had spent the $65 million to create poison for the public so that he or his successor or the corporations could coerce you into taking that. Yeah, he's a bad guy. His crimes pale in comparison to our president's, doesn't it? Absolutely pales in comparison to the crimes of Trump and now Biden. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Has your news been censored, banned over and over again? Has vital information been held prisoner by mainstream and anti-social media? It's the duty of every thinking person to make the great escape to thedavidknightshow.com. There you'll find links to live streams, videos, audio podcasts, and support links. Live stream the show at DLive and Trovo every Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern. Videos at BitChute and YouTube. New audio podcast, The Real David Knight Show, at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, iHeart, Spotify, and more. But even though there's a light at the end of the tunnel, without your support, the show will run out of gas. The links to support the show are at thedavidknightshow.com. To donate via Subscribestar, donate via PayPal, or donate via Venmo, Cash App, Bitcoin, or P.O. Box. Our sincere thanks to all of you who have stood with us to get this far. Please don't forget to share the links and pray for the country as well as our family.
All right, and we really do appreciate your support. Again, if you want to send us comments, information, articles, things like that, DavidKnightShow@protonmail.com. You can also send us support, financial support there via email link. You can just send with PayPal. You can send money to an address, and that address is davidknightshow@protonmail.com. We also have Subscribestar. If you'd like to just sign up for an ongoing amount each month, anything from $5 up, you can sign up for that. You can also just make a one-time contribution there at Subscribestar as well, The David Knight Show there. But if you go to The David Knight Show, you will see all the links to where the program is in terms of live streams. You'll see direct links, as well as the videos. We put the full show up each day. We put in topics by time code to help you, since it's about 3 hours long. I used to do a three-hour broadcast, but there was an hour worth of commercials in it. So now instead of a two-hour show, it's a three-hour show. So we give you indices into the content there. And then we also cut out some additional videos, and we're up on BitChute, YouTube, Rumble, and Odyssey. We had a lot of people request Rumble and Odyssey, but I don't see a lot of people who are basically following that channel or watching on there. So let us know. If we don't see a lot of people on those sites, we will not continue to upload to those sites. We also have podcasts. You'll find all the links to all this stuff at thedavidknightshow.com. A podcast, one of the primary podcasts that was under my name, was withheld for 3 months. We started doing it on a regular basis last week. A lot of people say, oh, I'm glad to see that you're broadcasting again. And that happened because that was reactivated. We started another podcast, and it looked like we weren't going to get that back. And we had, it was basically one person inside InfoWars who no longer works there, who helped us with that. And well, he was still there to get that back. But we set up the real David Knight Show and put that off of Podbean, and that pushed it out to a lot of different venues. But now the other one is back. We're able to get that back. And so now we're updating to the people who had followed us quite some time ago. So some of them saw the content that had not seen it. So all those links to all the different places you will find at thedavidknightshow.com. Let's talk a little bit about the Supreme Court, because as I mentioned it yesterday, and yesterday I told you how concerning it was, some of the people who were involved in this, things that their past history, which gives us a clue as to where they're going. Just understand, when we talk about leftist or rightist, what we're talking about in terms of the Supreme Court and the people who are pushing this, the wife of one of the two people who's heading up this commission is an avowed Maoist. So I think we could call them leftists, communists, without any exaggeration. She says her favorite philosopher is Chairman Mao. And this is exactly the kind of power play that you would expect from a Chairman Mao. But these are people who, and as we identify these political appointees that we call Supreme Court justices, as we identify them left or right, what I'm really talking about here are people who are on the left. These are people who do not adhere to the text of the Constitution. They see it as a living document. In other words, the law comes out of their mouth. They're not limited by the text there. They're free to make rulings based on their personal opinion, based on laws that they see in other countries or at the UN. And they can do that and disregard what the Constitution says at the same time. I mean, you can go back and see it in Roe v. Wade. At the beginning of Roe v. Wade, they actually say, well, you know, we can't just make this stuff up. We got to follow the Constitution. And they did anything but. What they did on the basis of their decision was they said, well, we've talked to philosophers and to scientists, and we've looked at the laws in other countries and on and on and on. They didn't make any reference in the rest of the document. You know, they just paid lip service to the Constitution and the preamble to the decision, but the decision itself was based on opinions that they got elsewhere, along with their own opinions, to determine when life begins. If they had looked at the Constitution, they would see that they had no authority to decide when life begins in the first place. It wasn't even their decision to make. It was a decision to be made at the state level. But they usurped that authority. So when we're talking about people left or right, we're talking about people who are either believe that the Constitution as written is what governs them, or people who say, I will be the governor of what you say. And people who also have a socialist Marxist perspective, who are social activists, judicial activists. That's what we're talking about. There's very precious few who aren't. Occasionally have a Scalia, Alito, Clarence Thomas. It remains to be seen what these three from Trump are going to be. But now they've come out. Yesterday we talked about what they're planning on doing. We talked about the hypocrisy of Joe Biden, saying, how dare you even ask me? You don't have a right to know. On October the 20th, before just 2 weeks before, maybe not even 2 weeks, yeah, about 2 weeks before the election, you don't have a right to know. Now, he did say in the past that packing the Supreme Court was just a cynical power play. In 2005, he said to pack the court was just a power grab. But that's exactly what he's doing now. So what does this power grab look like? This is a bill that was introduced by Jerry Nadler, Subcommittee Chair Hank Johnson, and new representative Mondaire Jones. And what they want to do is increase the number of Supreme Court justices from 9 to 13. This article from Breitbart says that that would give the liberal justices, in other words, the statist justices without any regard to the Constitution and with their will to enact their own agenda, that would give those types of justices a 7-6 majority. I thought, 7-6 majority, how do they get that? Oh, that's right. It's not just Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and the three judges that were just appointed by Trump, Barrett, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. That's five. And we've seen a lot of 5-4 rulings. Why do we see 5-4? Because Roberts is not one of these people who believes in what the Constitution says. And we have seen this for a very long time now. I don't know when people like Breitbart are going to stop calling him a conservative judge. Being appointed by a Republican doesn't make you a conservative judge. Conservative trying to conserve the Constitution. Quite the opposite. So it's not going to be, if they pack this, it's not going to be a 7-6 majority. It's going to be an 8-5 majority. 8-5 is what it's going to be. Now, is that the end of the world? Or the end of America. You have Tom Cotton saying packing the Supreme Court would destroy the Supreme Court. Is that a bad thing? See, that's what I said yesterday. I said, is this going to be a bad thing if they go ahead and do it? It's going to destroy the Supreme Court. It will destroy judicial supremacy. It'll destroy this head fake that these people are somehow ruled by law and that they should be allowed to rule us. It will expose them as faithless political operatives who are out to push an agenda. And it's about time we wake up to that. So I see this as having a silver lining. We need to get over the idea that we're going to defer to the opinions of these politically appointed judges who can never be removed. So the Democrats will do anything for power. Yeah, we know that. Mark Meadows said the moderate left is gone. This is who they are now. Open borders, outlawing voter ID, free health care for illegal migrants, and now court packing. Good. I'm glad that they've flown their flag and their color so that we can finally organize and oppose them, because opposing them through the Supreme Court has never worked. As I said yesterday, I won't go into it in detail, but, you know, we had an approach to come after Roe v. Wade, just a few years old when Reagan took office. And it was going to be using the states to nullify the Supreme Court decision because they don't have it. That's the appropriate approach. Instead, you had all these people coalesce around Ronald Reagan and said, he's a great guy. He can get great Supreme Court appointments. Let's do it in the Supreme Court. And it hasn't worked for 40 years. And he didn't have very good appointments in the Supreme Court. He played political games. He put in Sandra Day O'Connor because she was a woman, and she turned out to be a very, very liberal justice. That was a criteria. It was a political criteria. It was identity politics. It wasn't about getting somebody who was solid. He put in Bork. It was a big fight. They backed off of that. But all right, that's it. We're not going to do any more ideological appointments. Let's just do a identity politics appointment. So Mondaire Jones, one of the guys who put this through, said, we have to do this to restore power to the people. We must expand the court. Well, let me tell you, the Supreme Court doesn't in any way, shape, or form represent the people. They're supposed to be there as impartial referees over court cases that to decide between states and things like that. But they have intruded themselves into every aspect of our lives without the authority. They do not represent the people. We do not vote for them. We cannot get rid of them. This is not about restoring power to the people. This is nothing other than a power grab, which is what Biden said back in 2015. It is not restoring power. It is a permanent power grab for the Democrats in the Supreme Court. So we need to focus on what we can do to shut this down. By the way, one of the other people involved in this is Senator Ed Markey. When he was a congressman about 8 years ago, he set up a dog and pony show. Again, one of the most dishonest people I've seen in Washington. And that's saying something, isn't it? When you stand out in that crowd as being a corrupt liar, that's really saying something. And Ed Markey is a standout. He set up this thing with Lisa Jackson, who was then the head of the EPA. They set up a dog and pony show. And they were telling everybody that fine particulate matter, which is what they were trying to regulate at the time, they're trying to outlaw all diesel exhaust. And so they're focusing on fine particulate matter. And PM 2.5, that's particulate matter of 2.5 nanometers and so forth. So at the time they were doing that, and she's testifying, and it was patently absurd. Lisa Jackson was saying that we're not talking about people getting sick here. We're talking about people dying. We have fine particulate matter is killing more people than cancer or heart disease. The same type of stuff we're hearing now about the pandemic, right? Oh, it's the leading cause of death and stuff. Absolute nonsense. And he had her there testifying, and they had worked up a dialogue, and he actually, you could tell, because he actually read some of her lines by mistake and then had to back it up. It was pathetic. What was even worse was that at the same time, there in North Carolina where I was, and I was the people that I was working with got involved in this and exposed it. Steve Malloy did the research and figured out what was happening there at the EPA Research Center there in North Carolina in order to game this and to make it look worse. They had searched for volunteers who had heart issues and respiratory issues, and then they hooked them up directly to a diesel tailpipe. They did filter out the carbon monoxide so they wouldn't die right away. And he noticed this because in one of their statements, they talked about people having to be taken out in ambulances because they had pre-selected people who had respiratory or heart issues and then deprived them of oxygen and fed them this particulate matter at levels that were 72 times higher than the EPA allowed. And they did that in order to try to show that there was a problem so that they could get more stringent regulation. So to get more stringent regulation, they expose these people to 72 times what they said is the worst that you can do. Now think about that in terms of what we see happening today. We oppose it. We said this is a violation of the Nuremberg Code. You're experimenting on people. You're not telling them what is going on. And we were unable to stop it. We tried to get a restraining order to stop that. The judge said, nah, that's okay. They can experiment on people. Don't have a problem with that. But at the same time, she's telling everybody that it was killing people, even though we didn't have anywhere close to that level of exhaust anywhere, that people were dying from this, not just getting sick. They were exposing people to more than 72 times because we didn't have cities that were up to that level to start with. And this is Ed Markey, who was there right there with her at the beginning. And now he's one of the people pushing to pack the Supreme Court. So here's the answer, folks. And Reason Magazine got this one right. More than a dozen states are trying to nullify federal gun control. This is the way you do it. It's nullification. It's not lawsuits going up to the Supreme Court. It's nullifying what the federal government is doing. And if we don't take that approach, we're going to lose. Even with the Supreme Court, even without court packing, we're going to lose on this Biden agenda if we don't use the Ninth and Tenth Amendment and nullification. And nullification does not have to lead to a civil war. In 1831, 1832, you had a nullification crisis. South Carolina said they were going to leave the Union. Why? Because of tariffs. They called them the tariffs of abomination. And that was the beginning of the struggle between the established agrarian society and the new industrial powers as the Industrial Revolution was coming into play. That came to a head in the 1860s with the Civil War. At the same time, it was happening in other countries like Italy, where they had a civil war there at the same time. Why? Because of the Industrial Revolution. And that also was a change in the power structure, the political power structure. The creation of a more centralized nation state, replacing the decentralized power bases that were part of the agrarian society. So that was going on throughout Western civilization at the time. Our Civil War was not unique, and it was not about slavery, first and foremost. It was about the economic issues, and it was about the Industrial Revolution. So that began in the 1830s. The industrialized powers tried to set up tariffs to protect their manufacturing goods. They wanted to make goods manufactured in England and other places more expensive with taxes to help them internally. And the people who were part of the agrarian data, agrarian base, I always want to say database, part of the agrarian base, were wanting to have open trade without tariffs because their business was primarily exporting raw materials to the industrialized societies abroad. So that created the conflict. The tariffs were extremely high, and so much so that in South Carolina, they said, we're nullifying this, and if you don't get rid of this, we are going to secede. That whole thing was diffused by Andrew Jackson. And part of the reason that that was able to be diffused was because they were not at a generational cycle where people wanted to change all of the institutions. That happened later in 1860, and we're in the middle of that right now. People see that the institutions have failed. People see the institutions are corrupt. People see that there are no effective leaders at the top. And under these types of situations, and after four generations of living with the current system there, the last time we had the change was World War II and the Great Depression. After four generations of this, people are ready for a change. Just the cycle of civilizations. So we're heading into that again. But the nullification does not necessarily lead to civil war. They went another 30 years. What led to civil war was the competition between these different power bases and their desire to restructure the society. It wasn't about nullification. We'd had nullification before with the resolutions that were written by Jefferson and Madison, the Kentucky resolutions. So nullification is the rightful remedy, and it is the middle point between a full-on civil war. If you can ameliorate these pressures by nullifying things, then you don't go into a civil war. But if you don't, the pressures build up. On April the 6th, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, a Republican, signed the first gun control nullification bill into law. Anthony Sabatini, a Republican lawmaker, member of the Florida House of Representatives, said nullifying unconstitutional federal laws is both legal and also the right thing to do. And it is better to do it, than I'll add, than to try to appeal to the Supreme Court, which is a bunch of people who, you don't even get people in the Supreme Court unless they've gone through the system. So the rare situation is going to be when you get somebody who is who wants to follow the Constitution. Most of them are career bureaucrats and statists. In 1987, Oregon passed a law prohibiting state and local law enforcement from using public resources to arrest or to detain people whose only crime was being in the country illegally. This would be the sanctuary city issue. Now, I've talked about this before, and I don't really like using that as the basis for this, because when you look at that versus the Second Amendment, the people who are nullifying this, the nullifiers with the Second Amendment, are on the side of the Constitution. The people who are nullifying it at the local level are not on the side of the Constitution. They are saying that the federal government does not have the right to enforce immigration laws, and they do. That has been appropriately delegated to them. However, there's another, I think that the appropriate way to look at this is what happened with marijuana. That's an even more successful example of how this ought to run. And with marijuana, you have now 2/3 of states have legalized medical marijuana. There was never any authority in the Constitution to prohibit marijuana. It was a UN agenda that was created in 1961 for schedules. Marijuana was put in as a class one drug, saying that it had no medical use. Even in Texas, they recognize that marijuana has medical use, and they have one very narrowly defined exemption for medical use in Texas, where they do not recognize medical marijuana. But that exemption says that the war on drugs and the four different schedules are total nonsense from a pragmatic standpoint. But they don't have a legal standpoint. They needed to have a constitutional amendment just like they did when they prohibited alcohol. So that's the reason why drug warriors like Jeff Sessions did not challenge that, because they didn't want their fraud and their bluff to be exposed. And so one by one, you had state legislatures or the public and referenda make it legal. And the federal government never did anything about it because they didn't have a leg to stand on. That's the difference. Now, there's another approach that's being suggested by Michael Bolden. I've interviewed him with the 10th Amendment Center. I typically interview Michael Meharry with the 10th Amendment Center. I did a couple of weeks ago. What they're talking about is the anti-commandeering clause, saying that even if something is constitutional, like the immigration laws, you cannot commandeer local law enforcement or state law enforcement to help you with that. That's the anti-commandeering. And so Michael Bolden said, we know this stuff has been working, and the right can continue to play about the things that the left has been successful at, or they can look at it and they can learn from it and they can replicate it. In terms of the method, it's identical. When they created these sanctuary cities, they stopped reporting to or dealing with ICE, and that's basically what we're doing. He said the legal case for nullification does not depend upon the constitutionality of the law that a state wants to nullify, thanks to anti-commandeering, which has been upheld in five Supreme Court cases from 1842 to 2018. It holds that the federal government cannot require states and localities to participate in the enforcement of federal laws. Talking about constitutionality actually does kind of get in the way of this anti-commandeering. He said a lot of people like that as a line in the sand, and I think that is a good approach, but I don't think they should be helping to enforce federal gun control, even if a federal court says that the federal gun measure is constitutional. And he talks about the very first one of these anti-commandeering laws. It originated in 1842, a Supreme Court case, Prigg versus Pennsylvania. It upheld the state's right to not participate, listen, in enforcing the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793. The bottom line is that nullification is a tool banning participation in federal enforcement, and it was actually a tool of the anti-slavery abolitionist North. So you had the Fugitive Slave Act, which said if a slave escapes and goes to another state, even if that state doesn't recognize the legality of slavery, they were obliged to return it. And in Pennsylvania, they said, no, we are not going to enforce that. We're not going to be involved in that. And you can take that anti-commandeering idea, which, again, they've had five cases going all the way to 2018, the most recent one, to say we're not going to participate in laws that we disagree with. When you talk about jury nullification, as I pointed out many times in the case of William Penn, they arrested him because he was holding church services in the unofficial church religion. They first said, you can't meet. They continued to meet. They chained the doors of the church building, so they met on the steps, so then they arrested him. And the jurors said, well, he did violate the law. You get a law, and he violated it, and it's a legal law. This is not just a dictate that's coming from somebody like we have today when they shut the churches down. But this is a legitimate law. We don't like the law, and we don't like the penalty associated with the law. So if we don't like the penalty or we don't like the law, we just aren't going to do it. And that's what he's talking about here, the anti-commandeering. States have the ability to do that as well, states and local jurisdictions, to say we're not going to participate in a law that we feel is unjust, in the same way that jury nullification said we're not going to put William Penn in prison for having a Quaker church meeting. You point out when South Carolina seceded, they issued a document to explain the rationale. They specifically cited the fact that the North had used nullification as part of the Federal Fugitive Slave Act. They said people are sovereign and they can do these types of things. So if we're going to have a packed court, what is going to be the rightful remedy? It'll be to use the remedy that we should have been using for the last 40 years. That's the Ninth and Tenth Amendment. That's just to nullify what we disagree with. We have those powers. We've not delegated those powers to them. We don't have to enforce this. The reason the enforcement is happening is because of bribery. That's typically the way that it happens. It's the way that Trump locked us down. He bribed the governors and the cities who were bankrupt especially, gave them power, and he gave them money with the national state of emergency. And this is the way they have gotten around the law and the Constitution, and that is with bribery, unlimited amounts of money as bribery. Take a look at some more judicial tyranny here. And this is a case that just continues to get worse. In 2015, of course, David DeLeiden and the Center for Medical Progress, they set up an undercover investigation. There had already been testimony in Congress that there was trafficking for baby parts being done in abortion clinics. And so because of that testimony and because of that, they decided that they would do an undercover investigation and expose this. And so in 2015, they released footage of Planned Parenthood officials negotiating the sale of body parts. And not only that, but negotiating on how they're going to acquire them. Because depending on what parts were wanted by, now we learn because of this trial, that some of those parts were going to be going to the FDA and other federal agencies. So depending on what they want, it would change how they extracted and killed the baby. It now appears, however, that as this court case is in, a unilateral declaration by a judge is going to keep anybody from seeing any further information about this criminal murder for hire of babies. Audiences will be prevented from reviewing now hundreds of hours of footage that expose the abortion industry's illegal trafficking scheme, reports WND. On April the 7th, Judge William Orrick awarded a permanent injunction ordering that the undercover videos recorded by DeLeiden are to remain sealed. His recent decision barred the release of additional footage indefinitely. Yes, murder for hire of babies is now in the same category, I guess, as information about JFK or 9/11. If these videos involved any issue other than abortion, you would have seen them by now, says the people who are defending them. They said, and as a matter of fact, animal rights organizations filed a friend of the court submission on the side of David DeLeiden. Imagine that. You know, because these people who say they're pro-choice, and of course they're the ones who want you to be coerced into getting a genetic modification jab and a genetic code injection, they will many times freak out about what is happening to an animal. But they will not care about what is happening to human babies. And yet, Animal Outlook, PETA, other animal rights organizations have filed a friend of the court brief on the side of David Lyden and the Center for Medical Progress, arguing that lower court decisions could set a standard where investigative subjects can sue undercover journalists. And that's exactly what's happening. With the help of Kamala Harris, Javier Becerra, people who are now the vice president and the head of HHS, these are the people who criminalized the undercover investigation to cover up the crimes. But we already saw what the crimes are. They said if the National Abortion Foundation did not want its trade show recorded, they could have taken steps to secure it. The judicial decision disregards expert reports from an abortionist, Forrest Smith, one of the country's longest practicing abortion providers. He wrote that the footage showed Planned Parenthood staff members violating, quote, the medical standard of care. What they were doing was abhorrent even to one of the best known, longest practicing abortion providers. But the judge, Ork, chose to ignore his expertise and rely on his own personal opinion, his own personal assessment. So the attorney is representing David Lyden said, and so when you have a federal judge sitting by himself and opposing medical experts, opposing prosecutors, opposing other legal experts, that puts the federal judge in the position of censure over information that the American people need to see. But it is exactly what we have seen with judicial supremacy. What that particular judge is doing, Orrick, in the case of this abortion case, is in principle the same thing that these nine judges have been doing to Americans for a long time. And it's time that we get past the idea of judicial supremacy, especially Supreme Court supremacy. You want to talk about this being, we need to have this to have better representation for the people, as this guy, this new congressman, tweeted out. When you look at the decision that was enforced on Americans by the Supreme Court in terms of marriage, we had, even in the Bill Clinton administration, they had the Defense of Marriage Act, but you had, as these bills were put out there for homosexual marriage, you had referenda where the people voted, or you had their elected representatives vote, or you had marriage is between one man and one woman in every one of, and pretty much most of these constitutions. So you had state constitutions that opposed homosexual marriage. You had specific referenda, and you had new laws that were put in to oppose it. They didn't win even in California, even with millions of dollars poured in by Tim Cook, an Apple computer. They lost even in California. The Supreme Court imposed their will in an area in which they have no authority to make a decision on all the different states. So regardless of what you think of these issues, that should concern you, especially in light of what we see with the pandemic now. And so it's time that we move on from this system. And it could be that the desperate power grab of the Democrats could be the thing that backfires on them. However, in this environment, the thing that surprised me over this last year, the only thing that surprised me, was that there was not a pushback when they went this far, this fast. What Scott Atlas said as well from Stanford, he said, I cannot believe how far they went, how quickly they went, and how passive the American people were. Because typically you think if they're going to change things that quickly without any basis whatsoever, people would push back. But that's the danger, is that people will just put up with the tyranny. I think that may be where we are right now. We may have our heart set on becoming slaves. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk about, John Cleese had something to say about Hank Azaria. We'll talk about America Held Hostage, and then in the third hour, we're going to be joined with a Polish preacher who on Easter Sunday, you saw the viral video, throwing the people out of his church, but his background and what he's been doing for several decades, I think you're going to find very interesting. He's been in this fight for a long time. Not his first rodeo, as we say. We'll be right back.
Has your news been censored, banned over and over again? Has vital information been held prisoner by mainstream and anti-social media? It's the duty of every thinking person to make the great escape to thedavidknightshow.com. There you'll find links to live streams, videos, audio podcasts, and support links. Live stream the show at DLive and Trovo every Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern. Videos at BitChute and YouTube. New audio podcast, The Real David Knight Show, at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, iHeart, Spotify, and more. But even though there's a light at the end of the tunnel, without your support, the show will run out of gas. The links to support the show are at thedavidknightshow.com. To donate via Subscribestar, donate via PayPal, or donate via Venmo, Cash App, Bitcoin, or P.O. Box. Our sincere thanks to all of you who have stood with us to get this far. Please don't forget to share the links and pray for the country as well as our family.
Of course not! You are English type, sir!
Well, what are you then?
I'm French! Why do you think I have this outrageous accent, you silly king?
What are you doing in England?
Mind your own business!
If you will not show us the Grail, we shall take your castle by force.
You don't frighten us, English pig dogs. Go and boil your bottom, sons of a silly person. I'll blow my nose at you, so-called Arthur King. You and all your silly English kniggets.
What a strange person.
Now look here, my good man.
I don't want to talk to you no more, you empty-headed animal food trough whopper. I fart in your general direction. Your mother was a hamster, and your father smelt of elderberries.
Is there someone else up there we can talk to?
No. Now go away, or I shall taunt you a second time.
And he did taunt them a second time. As a matter of fact, he was taunting on Twitter. He said, not wishing to be left behind by Hank Azaria, I would like to apologize on behalf of Monty Python for all the many sketches that we did making fun of white English people. We're so sorry for any distress that we may have caused. And so I guess that's just one of the best examples of him. But he did it in every way, every class, every group of people. And then as the... You have a lot of woke people attacking him on social media, and he has some very good comebacks against them as well. One person says, well, what about the French? I feel triggered since 1975, and I was born in 1983. I guess it was because, you see, when you see that, he's also making fun of the French at the same time the Frenchman is making fun of the Englishman. The whole thing is about learning to laugh at ourselves and not take ourselves so seriously. Wouldn't it be nice if we could go back to the way things used to be a few years ago, just a few years ago? I mean, we don't even have to say the 20th century, where we could laugh at ourselves and we could laugh at others instead of having this straight-laced, Stalinesque kind of approach. You know, I grew up knowing what had happened in Stalin and how everybody had to be so careful in the Soviet Union about what they did. I mean, you had composers like Shostakovich constantly looking over his shoulder, worried that he was getting, you know, his people who didn't like him, who were trying to get ahead of him, would accuse his music of being too bourgeois, too much influenced by the West, that type of thing. So you had to carefully look at what you were doing. Same thing was true about architects. Every field was under the scrutiny of these people who set in judgment of your motives. That was what it was about. It was Marxism. One person says, there's a lot of white people on here trying to be offended on behalf of non-whites. Seriously. Yeah, that's where this is typically coming from, because this is not really fundamentally about race. This is about Marxism and their attempt to divide us. What is the deal with white people attacking other white people so they can look virtuous in front of other white people? Exactly. One person responded and said, as someone who has been relentlessly teased all my life for walking in a silly manner. I hope you get what's coming to you, Mr. Cleese. You had one person said, for the record, I'm Chinese, and I find the I Like Chinese song to be hilarious. Another one says, as much as I love Python and that era of comedy. No, it's just comedy, right? It was just the idea that we did have an era prior to the last 5-10 years where we could actually have comedy. Remember when we had comedians on late night shows? They tried to be funny instead of politically correct. They're not funny anymore. They really aren't funny. It's disgusting. Anyway, as much as I loved that era of comedy, it's pretty painful to look back at stuff like Eric Idle and Blackface on the show, or Bonzo Dog Doodah Band's similar antics on Do Not Adjust Your Set. John Cleese replied and said, I expect you'll recover eventually. That should be our reply. Just, you know, get over it. Grow up. Quit being so hurt about everything. One person says, the best jokes are those that don't make fun of gender, age, physical appearance, race, religion, nationality, culture, language, or personal habits. Also, any jokes about sensitive current events are totally unnecessary. And John Cleese says, well, actually, all jokes are unnecessary. But a few people get pleasure from them, although only the ones who have a sense of humor. Another response, as a descendant of a Welshman, I feel left out and humiliated. John Cleese comes back and says, you don't understand. That's how all Welsh people feel. No apologizing to the Romans then, says another. After all, what have the Romans ever done for us? John Cleese said, they enslaved us for over 3 centuries, and they owe us reparations. Yeah, it is unlike what Biden's ambassador to the UN said. This is not the original sin of America. It's the original... goes back to the original sin of mankind. Man, that wokeism is going too far, in my opinion, acting like a ministry of good taste and censorship and lacking a decent sense of humor. John Cleese replied and said, it started out as a good idea. Let's be nice to people. And it finished up as a humorless, censorious, literal-minded, posturing idiocy. Well, I disagree with him on that. I don't think it was ever based on good intention. Some of the people who fell for it might have had good intentions, but the people who were pushing this from the very beginning were people like Bill Ayers. This had already been done, as I pointed out, in Stalin's Soviet Union. This is a tactic of governance, and we should have recognized and opposed it for what it was instead of saying, well, it'd be nice to be nice to people. You must not embrace this. This is about attacking not just free speech, but free thought. Free thought from the very beginning. That is what totalitarianism is ultimately about. Not just controlling, not just being authoritarian in every aspect of your life, but controlling and shaming you, getting you to self-censor. And they might come at you to show this as, let's just be nice to people. That's not their agenda. Not at all. As a matter of fact, when we talk about Hank Azaria, Apu, and I played the clips yesterday of Peter Sellers doing the Indian guy. He played an Indian guy in an entire movie, The Party. And everybody else is heavy stereotypes as well. That's what comedy typically is. It exaggerates characteristics that are unique to different types of people. And it can be something that is unique to an entire group of people or a culture or just to particular individuals that are there. You know, Hank Azaria did 11 different characters on The Simpsons. 11 different characters. And he feels that it is necessary to apologize for Apu. But what I didn't realize when I looked up to see how many different characters he did, because I'm not a big Simpsons one, frankly. I think they're funny, but, you know, again, they a long time ago, they got a little bit too much into politics for me. I could still appreciate the humor. I could still laugh at myself, but it got a bit tiresome. But so I don't know all these different characters. I don't know Dr. Nick or Lou or Wise Guy or Snake or Comic Book Guy or Professor Frink or the Sea Captain. There's a whole bunch of these that are referenced, but 11 characters that he did. As they pointed out, he voices the most characters on the show. And he's most famous for his voiceover work on The Simpsons. And he is just groveling for forgiveness. The very first one they mentioned, Apu, they said, was based on Peter Sellers' character, Harundi B. Bakshi, from the movie The Party that I showed you yesterday. He based it on that. Actually, Peter Sellers did it a lot better. He did it longer. and he did it in blackface, too, if you will. I mean, he put some darkened his skin a little bit. That's why I played that. We have to get into their face. We have to not say that we're going to play by their rules. We have to not self-censorship. Whenever they're going to censor people, we need to step it up. And we need to laugh harder in their face. Some of the other characters he based on, Al Pacino, or Edward G. Robinson, or Sylvester Stallone, or Ricky Ricardo, or Charles Bronson. An old college roommate was the inspiration for one of these. But anyway, they talk about the different characters that inspired him. But now he is playing a different character. He's playing a groveling Hollywood actor who is so desperate for approval that he will destroy the foundations of our country. Let's take a look as the foundation of our country is being destroyed. Day 397 of America held hostage. Food prices are rising aggressively. Even corporate media admits that it's only going to get worse. This article from Michael Snyder, Economic Collapse blog, you can also find on Zero Hedge. And it is very true. When we look at that, and it's not just food. Look at the price of gasoline. Look at the price of lumber, we pointed out. Look at the cost of housing, because it's not just lumber. It's many things that go into building a house. And also the demand for housing. But also especially food. According to the Department of Labor, consumer prices overall were up only 0.6%. But that was just in 1 month. Nevertheless, we all know how the government rigs the inflation figures, just like they rig the unemployment figures, or they rig the coronavirus numbers, right? Every statistic that comes out of the government, they've rigged it one way or the other. And as a matter of fact, the Labor Department will always rig the unemployment figures. They will do a retro-rigging, if you want to call it that. They'll always adjust the previous quarter, virtually every time they do this. They adjust the previous quarter's unemployment figures up so they can make these unemployment figures look better. And they were working overtime last year to manipulate the data as everything was being locked down and shut down with Trump's executive order going into another Great Depression. They were spinning that as hard as they were spinning the number of cases here. John Williams of ShadowStats.com says that if the rate of inflation was still calculated the way that it was back in 1980, the inflation rate would be over 10% right now. In other words, we have reached the levels of inflation that we had under Jimmy Carter. Under Jimmy Carter. And you understand that Trump is the Jimmy Carter of the GOP. Weak, failed president. Jimmy Carter, on the other hand, was a nice guy. Outside of the presidential politics, I think he's be a nice guy. We'll have to wait and see about Trump. I don't think he's going to change, though. Inflation and food prices, for example, let's just take a look at our own stuff here. So you've got a guy, John Williams, saying if they calculated it the way that they did back in 1980, it would be over 10%. So let's just take a look at a few items that were selected. Before the pandemic began, the price of bacon in January 2020 was $4.72. By last month, the price had soared to $5.11. So bacon up by 8%. According to exclusive supermarket point-of-sale data from Nielsen IQ, ground beef is up to $5.26 a pound from $5.02 a pound. That's a 5% increase. Bread is up from $2.44 a loaf to $2.66 a loaf. That is a 9% increase. So, ground beef, 5% up. Bacon, 8% up. Bread, 9% up. Again, same ballpark as what he's saying in terms of 10% inflation. Yahoo News recently posted an article that listed four explanations for rising food prices. Number one, plummeting food production. Why is that happening? Well, because of the lockdown by the government. Number two, transportation tumult. Why is that happening? The lockdown. Number three, more eating at home. Why is that happening? We know. And number four, wild weather. That is the only one that is a wild card, the wild weather. The wild weather may continue. We don't know. We can't predict it, can we? In spite of what you might want to believe, they're not able to predict the weather accurately, even a few days out. Certainly not what's going to happen the rest of the year. Certainly not what's going to happen in several decades with climate change. So we don't exactly know what is going to happen with that. But out of those four factors, three of those are the lockdown. Three of those we could end if we would stop playing along with this Fauci charade, this Bill Gates, WHO, NIH charade. We could stop three of the four issues that are here. You're always going to have weather that can affect food production. But these other things are really the dominant factors. They're man-made. They're government-made. But they're also, in the larger sense, man-made because we have played along with this. We're experiencing this because we won't push back. And so we're literally starving ourselves as well when we play along with this. We're not just depriving ourselves of oxygen with a mask, but we're starving ourselves. And it's even worse globally. Talking about an 8 to 10% uptick in food prices here. Globally, the global food price indexes, according to Statista, from the beginning of 2020 till now, we've seen a 30% rise in food prices. U.S. intelligence is issuing an ominous warning over, quote, sustained economic downturn and other long-term threats. In the next 20 years, they say, the pandemic is expected to contribute to humanitarian and economic crises, political unrest, geopolitical competition, and will strain governments and societies. Over the next 20 years? You realize, of course, that like the war in Afghanistan, they have no interest in ending the war on each and every one of us. That's what makes me concerned about the fact that's why they're bringing the troops home. Maybe that's to step up the war against us. Because as I've pointed out many times, when you go to war with somebody, you can see this happening right now with Iran. The first thing they do when they go to war with somebody, a group of people, they enact economic sanctions, and that's what we had enacted with us last year, economic sanctions. In America, but in every one of these countries, economic sanctions against the middle class, and now I believe they're going to step this war up. But clearly, as they're looking at this annual threat assessment and what's going to be happening over the next 20 years, they believe that this is all going to continue. It's all coming from them. These are the people giving you this assessment who created this. They initiated this pandemic lockdown. This is not a response to something that just happened, even as a deliberate attack of release of a virus. This is not a pandemic. I pointed out last week that homeschool co-op that my wife volunteers for canceled on Friday because there was a stomach virus that's going around. You know when there's a stomach virus going around, don't you? And everybody's getting sick and throwing up for a couple of days. You know when that is happening. Everybody talks about it. It's not a secret. You don't have to turn on CNN to find out that there's a stomach virus going on in your neighborhood. But you have to turn on CNN and Fox News to find out that there's a coronavirus pandemic going on, don't you? And we didn't lock everything down because there's a stomach virus. We just decided, okay, we're just not going to meet right now. Let's get this thing over with. It's fake, but it's also unending, just like the Afghanistan war. The economic fallout from the pandemic, they said in their report, the same people, the intelligence agencies who are running this economic sanction and plan on running this war for another 20 years against us, they said the economic fallout from the pandemic is likely to create or to worsen instability in at least, and perhaps many, countries as people grow more desperate in the face of interlocking pressures. Where are these interlocking pressures coming from? Our own government. All of that. Just to point out this, out of the four factors, three of them are government created. That include sustained economic downturns, job losses, and disrupted supply chains. Food shortages and uneven access to COVID treatments will continue to contribute to humanitarian concerns. They also warned of domestic extremism. This is where they tie this together to show that, as we know, this pandemic is political. This pandemic is manufactured by our government, modeled by the Chinese, pushed here, and manufactured by these people. And so they say, well, the threats from foreign terrorist organizations such as ISIS and Al-Qaeda is slowing down, but we're seeing an increase in white supremacy as the threat. Do you see how these people are shifting? And this may be what is behind Biden's move to stop the war. It's being portrayed as rational, and it would be rational to stop the war. It would be what America wants, but I think it is a repositioning to say our real enemy is not Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and I know that's not their real enemy. They've been funding Al-Qaeda and ISIS for decades. But now they're going to say that the real enemy are white people. They said to support this, there's been 26 lethal attacks that killed more than 141 people and dozens of disrupted plots in the West since 2015. But in this article by Michael Snyder, he points out that's fewer people killed in 6 years than we had just in Chicago year to date. Year to date, we've had 170 homicides in Chicago. You want to say that that's rival drug wars for the most part. Drug gangs, part of the drug war. The drug war is quite literally a war. But you could say that's black extremists against other black extremists. But no, this is white supremacists. White extremists are the real enemy. It's not Antifa. It's not the drug gangs. It's not ISIS. It's not Al-Qaeda. It's white people. And when you look at the videos, they've been planning this just like Davos has been planning the Great Reset. They talked about how there was going to be total chaos, how there would be people would be locked into the cities, you wouldn't be able to move. The Pentagon had its own videos. It's not just Davos. It's not just the UN with their 2030 agenda. The smart cities are not a sanitized, green utopia. The Pentagon painted a picture of that looked more like Ready Steady Go by Steven Spielberg. Ready Player One, that's it, Ready Player One, where you see people living in their little virtual world inside a physical hovel, packed into these lean-to sheds. That's really the way the Pentagon envisions it as well. Shown to us by Steven Spielberg. But of course, it all turns out well, doesn't it? Just like it always does in Hollywood. They like to reveal their method. They like to reveal their dystopia. And then they bring in one hero who's going to fix it all for you. This is what it really looks like already. The UK cops breaking down a door, arresting a man because they say he did not go to quarantine when he entered the country. They enacted rules to fine you up to £5,000 if you leave the country without having their permission. And so they, in a video, they kick in the door. You see the glass breaking. The woman who's there says, "Where's your warrant?" They reply, "Martin, you're under arrest for a breach of COVID regulations. You failed to quarantine in a designated hotel when instructed to do so." Well, Reykjavik, Iceland, that's the capital of Iceland, they just had a court ruling that mandatory stays at COVID quarantine hotels are illegal. That's what a court in the capital city of Reykjavik in Iceland said. In 7 cases last week, they had forced people to stay in a quarantine hotel. They said in these 7 cases, it's illegal. They said it lacks legal basis. This is a dictatorship that is being ushered in on us. The government had mandated, beginning April the 1st, that all travelers arriving in Iceland from countries with high number of COVID cases must quarantine in hotels designated by the government. And they were required to stay in the quarantine hotel until they received the result of a second COVID-19 test proving that they did not have the virus. So you are diseased. Why? They don't even have to say that you were in contact with somebody who was sick. You can come in asymptomatic with no evidence whatsoever that you've been in contact with anybody. You are guilty because you came from a country that has reports based on PCR tests that magnify viral debris by a factor of a trillion and create cases. Because of that, and that alone, that is the basis to detain you. We've got to stop this. There's no point in arguing. We all know where this is going now. It doesn't matter what they do at any given point. You know they're going to continue to push and push and push. Nothing will satisfy these people. They demand absolute power, and they will not stop until they have destroyed everything in our society. In the same way, these people who are coming after comedy will not stop until they have destroyed all speech, all culture. They're going to come after Shakespeare. They're going to come after Beethoven. They're going to come after Monty Python. You know, first they came after Shakespeare. I did nothing because I wasn't Shakespeare, and he was dead. Then they came after Monty Python, and the last guy standing fights back. Good for him. Rowan Atkinson is also fighting back, Mr. Bean. But too many of the people who are very insecure, that's how they rule the Hollywood crowd, very insecure about where they are. They are complying with all this. In Iceland, the Ministry of Health says it is now reviewing the ruling. And so they've now, because the judge said there's no law here, so now they're going to get the parliament to pass a law, to pass a bill, to provide a legal basis for forcing travelers to stay in a quarantine facility. The chief epidemiologist, and I will not even try to pronounce his name. I've never seen even these kinds of characters with all these accent names. Anyway, the chief epidemiologist of Iceland said the ruling is a major blow to the country. Now, it's a major win for individual liberty. Let me give you another example, because this is global. And it is the same agenda everywhere. The speed at which it is happening is different based on what they have calculated you will put up with. But everywhere, it's moving far faster than many of us ever thought it could. In Hong Kong, and they have used the pandemic to shut down these people who have been tirelessly protesting the encroachment of communism in Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, they just sentenced an anti-communist leader, Joshua Wong, to prison because he wore a mask. This is like a dog bites man, right? Actually, I guess you could say it's man bites dog. It's a complete reversal. The problem is, in Hong Kong, in October 2019, because the government couldn't control the freedom protesters, they passed a law in October 2019 to outlaw the use of masks in public. And then shortly after that, a couple months, they passed a law requiring you to wear a mask in public. So they got two laws there. So it is now both legal and illegal to wear a mask in public in Hong Kong, which is exactly where they want you. The government and the police can decide when you're a criminal and when you aren't. When the law is sufficiently complex, as we frequently see with bureaucratic law, like from the IRS and so forth, when it's sufficiently complex, it's the same as having no law at all. Or if even better, you have two contradictory laws. So whether you wear a mask or you don't wear a mask, you're violating the law. Either way, they can single you out. He's 24 years old, but there's another individual who's 74 years old, that they also got on this. I'll tell you what he had to say. But what makes this even more interesting in terms of showing what the intent of these people are is that his violation happened on the same day that the anti-mask law went into effect in October 2019. Defense attorneys argued that Wong never disguised his identity. Given his high profile, he wore a mask only for a few minutes during remarks to the press to protest the mask. So he shows up at the rally. He's there at the rally. And then he gets up to address the press. And he puts on the mask as part of that address as a protest. At no time were the police officers unable to identify him. They know they didn't have the Wong man. Or did they have the Wong man? I don't know. The court sentenced a longtime dissident, 74-year-old, Ku Zi-Yu, that's his name, protest organizer, 74 years old, to 5 months in prison for the same transgression of wearing a mask. They'll get you for whatever. It's all about their arbitrary power. Ku already had 10 criminal sentences to his name prior to the latest conviction, and he is currently battling cancer, this 74-year-old. He said, "This will not be my last time in jail. There will be a 12th, a 13th. I might even intentionally violate the national security law next time." He wore a celebratory red ribbon flower that's used in Chinese weddings, and he drank beer to commemorate the occasion. Face coverings at protests remain illegal after authorities upheld the ordinance against them at unlawful assemblies in April. Hong Kong health officials have encouraged the use of sanitary masks in public, even when admitting that they don't have any impact on the virus. It's simply about power. Naomi Wolf is back and speaking. I talked yesterday about Scott Adams and his reprehensible take an attack on Naomi Wolf, one of the most vile authoritarians I know of in the press. Most of the people are doing this out of fear. He seems to do it because he likes to, because he loves to lick the boots. Perhaps he's been promised that he will be an insider. He thinks he's one of the smartest men on earth. He writes book after book after book where he lectures people on philosophy and religion as the smartest man in the world. And so he attacked Naomi Wolf. Here's what Naomi Wolf has had to say. She's continuing to go on various shows talking about this. She went on to a conservative radio show yesterday, and she said about Bill Gates, she said, "Gates is part of a hellish amalgamation alongside the World Economic Forum," that's Davos, "and China." She claimed the threefold alliance was issuing a directive to governments across the world to enforce restrictive lockdowns and promote a biosecurity state in which freedoms and liberties of the West will be suspended. She's exactly right about that. This is an article, by the way, from LifeSite News, titled, "Naomi Wolf Accuses Bill Gates of Ushering in a Biosecurity State, Attacking Freedoms and Liberties of the West." She also noted, "We know that deaths are being inflated. There's a 40% inflation in just one state, and it's the PCR tests." She says, when there's a real pandemic, you don't need a PCR, just as I was saying about the stomach virus. You know it. You know it. But unfortunately, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation funds our major media. See, that's how you control things, isn't it? Why is it so difficult? So many people get so angry with me because I pointed that out about President Trump. First of all, he has the authority to stop this stuff. He had the authority to fire Fauci from the very beginning. The buck stops with him, honestly. But no, we cannot criticize him. I get people telling me, you're attacking liberals or you're attacking MAGA. I'm just telling you what's going on. So get over your political identification and take a look at what is happening and how that's going to affect you personally. Forget this left, right, Republican, Democrat, blue, red dichotomy that they use to control you, black, white, whatever. Right? Forget that. Those are control tactics that they use. Look at what these people are doing to us. And how do they do it? They do it with money. In the same way that Bill Gates is controlling the media by giving millions to the New York Times, millions to the Guardian, millions to the CDC, 12 to 17 million, as a matter of fact. He controls the WHO, the biggest funder of the WHO now, bigger than any of the countries. The Telegraph in the UK gets millions. NPR gets millions from Bill Gates. Do you think that he's getting some control with that? And of course, when President Trump funds with billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars, when he funds the lockdown with that, when he funds the vaccines with that, do you understand what's going on here? I can't paint it any more clearly to you. That's how Biden is doing things. That's how he's enacting his agenda. With cash. You pay for play. That's how these people have always operated. And that's how Bill Gates is operating. But it's how the politicians in Washington operate as well. Getting back to Gates and Naomi Wolf. She revealed that an August 2020 article in the Columbia Journalism Review documented the financial support which Gates was providing to major news corporations across the globe. And this isn't even talking about what the big pharmaceutical companies are doing. They practically own Fox News and CNN and MSNBC and all the cable news and broadcast news companies because they're sponsors. Gates Foundation financial records Wolf discovered substantial financing not only of media, she said, but also K-12 education. One of Bill Gates' primary focuses focus has been Common Core education. And so you want to look at where all this nonsense, all this Marxist nonsense, all this gender gaslighting and all the rest of the stuff, it's coming from Bill Gates as well. She said it's a completely closed circle. Gates is heavily invested in COVID injections and in vaccine passports. Microsoft actually has a contract to build the vaccine passports. Even worse, that she's not talking about. Microsoft has a contract with DARPA to set up the CCPA. Now, they'll put it out as a C2PA because they don't want you to see Communist Chinese Communist Party in that. But it is the Communist Chinese Party. It is the same thing that they're trying to do that the Soviets tried to do to stop dissidents, and that is they used to record every typewriter's unique characteristics, hoping that they could track down who was typing dissident literature. Well, Bill Gates and DARPA are doing that. Microsoft is at the center of an effort to create a three-way control and identification of all documents created, whether it's a meme or whether it's a document, a written document, text, article, or whether it is audio or video, all of that using hardware companies, Intel and ARM processors, using Adobe and other software creators, and using the press to help them to spread this propaganda. So she says it's a completely closed circle. What the CDC does what Bill Gates wants because he pays them. The New York Times does what Bill Gates wants because he pays them, and so does The Guardian because he pays them. And all these governors, Republican and Democrats, were doing what Trump and Fauci wanted because he paid them. Wolf was a former political consultant to Bill Clinton and Al Gore. She warned viewers to avoid imagining that Bill Gates, the tech brothers, and China simply think like us because they don't. This is important. Listen to this. As I've said, continue to say many times, don't make the mistake of thinking they're like you. That's how psychopaths and serial killers get their victims. Ted Bundy seemed like such a nice guy. He was so polite and attractive until he strangled the women with their pantyhose after he raped them and did it repeatedly. They don't think like you. And they have more technical capability than you can imagine. She said they want to colonize the environment. They want to colonize the human body as business models. And so the pandemic and this whole buying up of influencers, allowing them to be the source for updates and the boosters that this vaccine will require, according to Moderna's own site. She said this is not science fiction. It's not someone who's thinking, maybe I won't suppress free will and human creativity of human beings and mask their children forever because that's a cruel thing to do. I wouldn't do that. So you think that these people wouldn't do that because you wouldn't do that. But they don't care about that. She says, it's kind of an Asperger's kind of psychopath with too much power. And they're surrounded by A, communists, who have perfected inhuman, anti-individualist thinking, and B, Silicon Valley guys who are making billions of dollars from it and also don't think in terms of human rights and freedom. They simply think in terms of a quote-unquote new space that they can monetize. You understand? It's not the first person to point out that these hyper-capitalists in Silicon Valley have the mindset and the ethics of communist mass murderers. They do. George Gilder said they're neo-Marxists. They've decided that they're smarter than you. You had Michael Bloomberg bragging about it like a supervillain. They're smarter than you. They're going to take your jobs. They're going to take everything that you have from you, as Klaus Schwab, Davos said. All they have to do is figure out how they are going to keep you from grabbing the guillotines and coming after them. And finally, before we take a break for our guest to get him on the line, the pastor out of Canada. Oh, he's coming on at 10:30. Okay, so we got more time. All right, so let me talk about this. I mentioned this briefly before. Indiana passes a bill declaring religious services to be, quote-unquote, essential. And at first you look at this, and my first instinct is we need to do everything we can to fight these people by whatever means we need to do. And so I don't want to criticize these guys too much. I would not criticize the representative who's doing this because he's doing what he can. But I would criticize the not the representatives, but the churches if they get satisfied with it. I hope the churches and the Christians don't see themselves as simply a lobbying group carving out exemptions for themselves. That is not what we should be about. We should instead be salt and light. We should be restoring integrity to government, integrity to our society. As I said earlier, it is a stench to God. He's made that clear over and over and over and over again in both the Old and New Testament. He hates powerful people taking advantage of other people. We should hate what he hates. Not just sexual sin and other things like that, where the church gets into these conflicts, and that's what the pastor who's coming on, that's the essence of the conflicts that when things got difficult for him. They didn't have a problem with him helping homeless people in his society. But when he started talking about what sin is, that's when they came after him. And so we need to oppose all types of sin, and this is one of the types of sin. And we should not just try to carve out exemptions for ourselves. We should, we've seen this happen here in Texas, seen Abbott offer cynical, I think, exemptions to churches to keep them quiet, and it worked. It worked. So the language of the bill that's being introduced in Indiana echoes prevailing divisions of activities into essential and non-essential. And see, that's the big part of the problem I have with it. Everything is essential. There should be no non-essentials out there. Everybody's life is essential. Everything that people do is essential. They're looking at this and saying, well, many religious leaders have expressed consternation over the past year when public worship and other religious services were judged to be non-essential, while liquor stores and magazine stands and tobacco shops remained open as essential. This is not about equality and slavery. And that's what we're talking about here. It's not about saying, well, you got a liquor store open or you got Costco open, so I should be allowed to be open. You're arguing from the standpoint of a slave. You're arguing that somebody can make the determination of what activities are essential and which ones aren't. They shouldn't have that decision. Your decision, even if it was a real pandemic, and as I point out, we would know because we know when there's a virus going around the neighborhood, you would know if it was a pandemic. It isn't a pandemic. This isn't the most deadly disease that humankind has ever seen, but it is the most deadly tyranny we've ever seen rolled out across the world, because we've just seen the very beginning of it now. The principles that have been laid down this last year and the technological chains that are being forged on us right now are the most deadly that mankind, more deadly than mankind has ever seen before. We've never seen this type of power. Yeah, the Romans ruled with an iron fist. Several centuries, they enslaved people. They didn't have this kind of technology. The East Germans didn't have it either. Bill Binney, when I talked to him, he said, you know, we're already well past the point of where the Stasi were. And he spent decades of his life monitoring what they were doing. He knows what they're doing. It's one of the reasons why he's pushing back against what the American government is doing, because the American government and all these governments are becoming exactly like the Stasi. They've recruited the bulk of the population to act and think like the snitches in East Germany, but they now have that high-tech advantage that they didn't have before. That's the thing that should really concern us. Human nature does not change, but now you're wedding human nature with technology that gives an inordinate amount of power to a few people, and this is why we must stand together and not try to carve out exemptions for ourselves. Well, I should be essential. No. Everybody has to be essential, or nobody is essential. Do you understand that? If these people can tell you, make these kinds of determinations, they will make the determination and they will take you out. So as we look at this, and as I said yesterday, when you look at the attempts to take down this Johnson & Johnson vaccine, I said, uh-oh, a couple of warning signs here. First of all, they're talking about how it's just a pause. They're not banning it. You have had Denmark ban the AstraZeneca vaccine. But this is not what is happening here. We are looking at a situation here. I think this is part of the calculated propaganda approach. And this is to remove vaccine hesitancy. That's why they're doing this. As I said yesterday, by ignoring, it was Johnson & Johnson, the vaccine that they put on pause. It was Johnson & Johnson in four states, four different sites in four different states where you had more than four dozen people who had very, very serious immediate reactions to the vaccines. That's very rare to have immediate reactions to. Many of them taken out in ambulances. They made absurd justifications for that, the state officials did, to reactivate that. And I think they realized that they had a real PR problem on their hand and that people knew that it was the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So they redirected everybody away from these four dozen people in four different states. They redirected everybody to a much rarer side effect that was also immediate, and that is this blood clot thing. Said, see, it's only six people. But we have to do due diligence. We have to be extremely careful because we want you to understand this is about science and your safety, and we're going to do everything we can to keep you safe. That's the danger. And now, as they did that, there is another wave of mainstream news articles talking about vaccine hesitancy. At the same time, they're talking about how we have to go through extra links to be safe, and so we need to take two more days or a couple of weeks maybe to take a look at this because, you know, in spite of the fact that they only looked at this for 2 months instead of 2 years, which is already too short, now they're going to just take another couple of week pause, and then they'll start it up again and say, see, we shut that down right away. And again, you have the role that President Trump is playing as the obliging stooge. They can't do that. They're going to kill people, right? We need to have everybody have the vaccines. And they'll come out and say, well, you know, President Trump, he wanted to be pretty reckless, but we're scientists and we're concerned about your safety. He's not. And so we did all the due diligence and, you know, you can trust us. Just don't trust him. Axios, the new vaccine threat is fear itself. See? Not this irrational fear of a virus that you don't see in your community. Like I said, we all know when it's going around. This is not going around. The FDA's decision to pause the use of Johnson & Johnson's coronavirus vaccine has set off a chain reaction of fear. That's exactly the opposite. They shut it down for six people, ignoring nobody is talking about what happened with four dozen people. That was everywhere. They had to come up with a new narrative to redirect you away from that. That's causing unnecessary drama, just as the vaccine effort is finally picking up speed, says Axios. We have to acknowledge the safety issues without exaggerating them, and that's exactly what they're doing, very cynically. Yeah, we acknowledge that, you know, we have this very rare serious, fatal blood clot issue. We're not going to talk about these other issues, though, because I don't want to exaggerate the danger. I want to downplay the danger. So the FDA is not obligated to keep potentially serious side effects a secret because they will affect fewer people than the coronavirus. Discovering and responding to new safety information is how the system is supposed to work. See, it works. We fixed it for you. Doctors say the narrative now, 7 million people got vaccinated. Only 6 people had a problem. Well, what happened to... how did we wind up with more than 10,000 people dead in the U.S. and Europe right after taking the vaccine? No. It's 6 people and only one of them died, they say. Poll says Americans are further polarized on vaccine safety after the pause. This is a poll done by Echelon Insights. I've not heard of them before. They may be pushing this in whatever direction they want. A new poll revealed that more than half of Americans are confident or more confident. More than half of Americans are more confident, and nearly one quarter of Americans are less confident after the CDC paused the use of the Johnson & Johnson shot Tuesday. Well, that's exactly the opposite of their headline, right? Now, they're saying that by pausing it, more than half of Americans are now feeling good about the science and the safety that Fauci is talking about. 58% of Americans are now more confident because they did the pause. Because they ignored the elephant in the room. They ignored the 2,800 people who have died in the first 3 months. More than had been reported as dying from a vaccine in the last 11 years combined. They aren't talking about that. And so we've got six people who had a very rare blood clot disease and only one person died. So we're going to pause this. Oh, good. You guys are watching out for my safety. The memo from the Hill says the specter of vaccine hesitancy rises after the Johnson & Johnson blow. That's what they will do. It rose because of those reactions, and so that's why they're doing the pause. Researcher cautions against vaccinating people who already had COVID. This is also something we've talked about before. That might be a two-step process that subsequent coronavirus infections might be more deadly after you've had the vaccine, but it also might be more deadly after you've had a coronavirus infection. Dr. Hooman Noorkazem said in an interview Tuesday on Tucker Carlson that such complications are not isolated to Johnson & Johnson vaccine, noting cases entered into the federal database, BEARS, regarding the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. And we're talking about more people, more deaths being reported in the first 3 months than the previous 11 years combined. That's all Pfizer and Moderna. 94% of those. Only just a little bit of that includes the Johnson & Johnson. So they're focusing on the Johnson & Johnson, keep people from looking at the tens of thousands of people who have been had serious adverse reactions and the nearly 3,000 people who have died from the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. NPR reports that Denmark has now dropped the AstraZeneca vaccine completely. AstraZeneca has not been used in the United States. So what we're seeing in terms of 3,000 people that died in 3 months, that has nothing to do with the AstraZeneca. But even as this was happening in Europe, most of the countries there and the European Medicines Agency were saying, it's worth the risk. We're going to continue. Denmark says no. They've cited the rare side effects, and they also say the epidemic is under control. Clearly, it is under control. But I want to play for you, before I play this statement of Jen Psaki, the press secretary for Biden, talking about how this is going to be targeted propaganda to specific demographic groups. 10,000 plus deaths reported by the U.S. and European agencies. More than 7,000 deaths have occurred in Europe, another 3,000 in the U.S. in the first quarter. More than 200,000 injuries worldwide have been reported. And again, we've never seen this soon. Pandemics was the best documented case of adverse effects from vaccines because it happened within about a year. of people getting vaccinated. This is happening virtually immediately. We've never seen this happening this quickly or in this magnitude. And yet, they press on. More than 10,000 people have died shortly after the COVID vaccine since December. American and European authorities have revealed the deaths include more than 7,100 in Europe, according to the European Medicines Agency, and 3,005 now, according to the CDC. As of Tuesday, Endura Vigilance, the EMA's database of suspected drug reaction reports, noted that 4,036 fatal outcomes after the vaccination with Pfizer's shot, as well as 1,922 and 1,234 deaths after the vaccines made by Moderna and AstraZeneca, respectively. So about 2,000 from Moderna, about 1,200 from AstraZeneca, 4,000 from Pfizer. Notice that they're not talking about Pfizer and Moderna here in the U.S. They're focusing on Johnson & Johnson. You notice Johnson & Johnson isn't even in these numbers in Europe yet. They did have 20 deaths from Johnson & Johnson because they're just getting started. U.S. government likewise has reported 3,005 deaths, more than 56,869 adverse events after coronavirus vaccinations as of April the 12th. Vaccine injuries in the U.S. are tracked by VAERS, which goes back to when they put in the immunity. They said they were going to track the vaccines so that they could make recommendations to the pharmaceutical companies to make sure that they had they improved the safety and the efficacy of these vaccines. And yet, when you had RFK Jr. ask them to see the data that they had and to see the recommendations that they had, they stonewalled. After a lawsuit, they finally admitted, we never kept any of that information. We don't care. Among the suspected adverse events reported by VAERS, 42% of deaths occurred in people who fell ill within 48 hours of getting their shots. Totally unprecedented. VAERS has reported thousands of other debilitating outcomes, like 620 instances of Bell's palsy, 110 post-vaccination miscarriages. This is absolutely, we used to not give, it wasn't that long ago, 5 years ago. We didn't give vaccines to pregnant women. Now we give them genetic code injections. Immediately started with miscarriages. What will happen to these children later on? Vaccination campaigns are apparently often carried out in nursing homes without making sure beforehand that the person affected has not already contracted an infection, which would weaken the immune system. They're already weakened. They're old. They have multiple comorbidities. They're going in and they're injecting them without their legitimate informed consent. They've isolated them from family members who don't see them. I had a video which I was going to play earlier this week, but I just decided against it. It's too disturbing. Going around, perhaps you've seen it on social media, three or four different individuals who were mentally handicapped and doing this to them as they're wailing and screaming. And they would do that even if it was a medical procedure that, the needle is scary. That's what they were yelling and screaming about. But knowing that these people do not have informed consent, and that nobody is standing in the gap for them, that was the thing that really bothered me, knowing that this stuff is not tested. Not just the pain of a jab, but knowing that this is untested, that they're using them for an experiment. That is what is really disgusting. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And before we go to break, I want to play for you what the press secretary, Jen Psaki, had to say about how they were conducting their vaccine hesitancy campaign. I pointed this out. Under President Trump, he'd set aside $250 million to the Ad Council. They're bragging that it was going to be their moonshot. Every time it's something that is big, excessive, unprecedented, it's a moonshot, right? And again, we've never seen anything. We've had all these different campaigns, like the Smokey Bear campaign, but we've never had anything of the magnitude and funding that is going to be used to convince people who are skeptical, people who are white conservatives and supporters of Trump, who literally is trying to stab them in the back with a vaccine, or the black community very skeptical of being used as guinea pigs because of what happened in Tuskegee. We should all be skeptical of that. But they're focusing on these different communities, like I showed you yesterday. Dapper Dan, you know, he's a rapper a fashion artist. So they use people like that that they can make a contact. That's why they're using Franklin Graham, Al Mohr, others like that to come after white Christians who are supporters of Trump who are reluctant. This is what Jen Psaki has to say about how they're rolling this out. It's targeted propaganda, demographically targeted propaganda, customized for you.
Also investing $3 billion to states and community-based organizations to strengthen vaccine confidence in the highest risk and hardest hit communities. And often people think of that as just black and brown communities, and that is not. As you've noted, that is also conservative communities, white evangelicals. It's a range of communities around the country. What we've found to be most effective is to work with these local organizations. So faith-based organizations, community health organizations, civic leaders, and others who can really get this message deeply in communities. We've also had a number of our members of our COVID team, from Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins, participate in a range of media interviews. You know, an example is Dr. Collins participated in the 700 Club. Dr. Nunez-Smith hosted a faith leaders roundtable. We're also looking for, we've run PSAs on the deadliest catch. We're engaged with NASCAR and Country Music TV. We're looking for a range of creative ways to get directly connected to white conservative communities. We won't always be the best messengers, but we're still trying to meet people where they are, but also empower local organizations.
Yeah, you got to kind of feel sorry for them. They don't really know how to reach out to white conservatives. That's not their demographic, right? But they know they can go to the 700 Club. They can go to NASCAR. They can go to country music. Of course, they've got Fox News because Fox News is sponsored by the big pharmaceutical company. So that should make it a little bit easier for them. Meanwhile, while they're pushing this out, specifically targeting pro-vaccine messages, the communities that they've identified as not wanting to be a part of this, you have YouTube. As I pointed out earlier this week, they pulled the plug on my channel there. They took down a video that was released by a Canadian legal group, the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. I believe this is the same group that is defending James Coates, pastor who was jailed for 35 days, and then they put up the three layers of fences around them. He's being defended by this same organization in Canada. They put up a video. Here's the title of the video: COVID, the political pandemic. And of course, one of my videos that they took down was 2020, the year the world became China. And it was talking about the same thing. That was about 2 months ago. This was put up on the April 10th on the group's YouTube channel. Within minutes, the video was taken down for allegedly violating YouTube's terms of services. They were able to post the video to Rumble, where it now has 21,000 views. That's good. I'm not getting any engagement at all on Rumble. I don't know what's going on there, but it's hardly even worth it for us to post anything there. We're getting engagement on BitChute and YouTube, where we've been posting for a few months, but the Rumble channel is kind of new. We did set up the Rumble channel. I think my former employees had put up a Rumble channel under my name that they then didn't promote, but I don't have access to my name on Rumble, so we put it up under Roundtable Report, so maybe people can't find it. I don't know. But Rumble's not working too well for us, but I'm glad it's working for them. Their director of communications told LifeSite News that the video was flagged by YouTube for medical misinformation. And, of course, as I pointed out, when they took down my channel, they said, you're not allowed to criticize what the authorities are saying. It's just that simple. I mean, this is this bold-faced, Stalinesque, Maoist propaganda. You're not allowed to dissent from what the authorities say. The video showed clips of Fauci flip-flopping on social distancing rules. Yeah, that was one of the three that they flagged on me, too, when I talked about Fauci. They don't like you poking fun of our American Stalin here. So because the government has decided religion is non-essential activity, governments across Canada are preventing Christians from worshiping together in person as they have for over 2,000 years. Church in the new Canada is illegal. Young children who have a greater chance of being hit by lightning rather than dying of COVID are being forced to wear a mask all day just to attend school, says a video narrator. Depending on the province, it is forbidden to spend time with friends, to work out at the gym, to be with an aging sick parent, to go out to dinner, to play a game of hockey on an outdoor rink, to leave the house after 8 p.m., or to leave the house at all unless it's considered to be essential by the government. YouTube doesn't want you to hear that. It may be true, but they don't want you to hear that. It is absolutely true. This is not misinformation. This is accurate reporting of what the situation is. This is not even an opinion. It is true. And you can add to that the fact that these people have decided that they are going to sit in judgment of what you are allowed to do. YouTube has now suspended Rebel News over election misinformation. Do you think it's over election misinformation, or do you think it's over them talking about what's going on with the lockdown? See, the election stuff, that was so 3 months ago, wasn't it? I mean, it was around January the 6th. Oh, that's it. You know, we had some people who got rowdy, and then we had the Capitol Police stand down, and so we are going to say that this is our new 9/11. This is our new justification for whatever force we want to apply to people, and it is also our justification for taking people down. But let me tell you, that was their justification for taking down groups. But now, when they say that that's why they took down Rebel News, that's not why they're taking down Rebel News, that three-month-old video. Because they're taking down videos of mine, just like they did of this JCCF. They do that within an hour or so. They're going after Rebel News, and they're auditing them because of what is happening in Canada. You saw, perhaps, and I haven't covered it, I didn't show the clips, how they were meeting in an Airbnb. They have been very adamant about opposing the lockdown Rebel News has in Canada. And so as they were in an Airbnb, they did not violate any of the laws in terms of the number of people and occupants that they could have there. But they went in, and in the process, they drug off two of the reporters in handcuffs. As they pointed out, this is revenge for what we've been saying. And when you look at what is happening with this is clearly revenge by YouTube. It's bad enough to see the police coming in and arresting the press because they don't like the content. But then they use their surrogates, YouTube, to go back and to suspend them over a video that's been up for 3 months, when YouTube is looking at this stuff, and they claim, and they've been shutting down people who are talking about election stuff immediately. And now they say that that's what that is about. We know that is not what it's about. We know that it is all political. We know that this is exactly what has happened in Soviet Union and China, the crackdown on free speech, the crackdown on the free press, crackdown on churches. All of this is a pattern of behavior. The fact that they would do this months after this, DeSantis saying that Google and YouTube are trying to serve as a council of censors. They've been allowed to do this now for 3 years. August the 6th, 2018, they took down my channel. Never had a single video that they complained about. They never gave me an answer why they took it down. They just said the email. They took it down, sent out an email. A complaint has been received. A complaint. They didn't say a video. They didn't identify a video that violated their standards. They took down a channel that I hadn't posted anything up to for a couple of years that had thousands of videos on it. They took down the channel that I was using at the time immediately, but never gave me an explanation. As many times as I contacted them, they would never respond, so I stopped contacting them. But they continued to send me that same email that said nothing. They continued to send that to me for several months. It was over 8,000 of those emails that I got. They sent it about every 10, 15 minutes. And the interesting thing to me about it was that it wasn't on a regular basis. It'd be anywhere from 8 to 15 minutes. Within that window, they would send another one of these things. And so I just started collecting them, set up a filter, and started collecting them in a folder so I could see how many they were going to send. So they've been doing this for a while, and the Republicans were asleep for a while, and President Trump wouldn't do anything because they weren't doing anything to him at that point in time, and he didn't care. and neither did the Republicans. And so now they're purging people left and right. They kicked Trump off. They're coming after DeSantis because he talked about how, as a governor, he talked about we shouldn't be masking up kids. No, no. YouTube's going to pull you down. Just like that. Governor of Florida. We're not going to allow him to talk. We are superior. And they established that under Trump. Trump set that precedent for them. You had a judge who said, you can't ban people on your personal account. And he said, oh, okay. Well, that's not fair, but oh, okay, I'll do it. He should have said, no, I'm president. I'm going to do whatever I want. And if they kick me off, I will take Twitter down because all I have to do is just use my personality and my celebrity status to establish something somewhere else. He didn't do anything. He held a Rose Garden conference of people who had not been censored. He had there the Heritage Foundation, Cato Institute, biggest conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, and they applauded the rights of corporations to do whatever they wish to us in the digital public square. That's the key thing, the digital public square. So now we're looking at being kicked out of the physical public square, out of public accommodations, because these big box Wall Street companies will decide what medical care you can and cannot have and which medical care you must have. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to get pastor out of Alberta on with us, Arthur Pulaski. We're going to establish contact with him, and we're going to play a quick break here, and then we're going to come in. Before we bring him in, I'm going to remind you of what happened at his church on Easter weekend. So we'll be right back.
Has your news been censored, banned over and over again? Has vital information been held prisoner by mainstream and anti-social media? It's the duty of every thinking person to make the great escape to thedavidknightshow.com. There you'll find links to live streams, videos, audio podcasts, and support links. Live stream the show at DLive and Trovo every Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern. Videos at BitChute and YouTube. New audio podcast, The Real David Knight Show, at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, iHeart, Spotify, and more. But even though there's a light at the end of the tunnel, without your support, the show will run out of gas. The links to support the show are at thedavidknightshow.com. To donate via Subscribestar, donate via PayPal, or donate via Venmo, Cash App, Bitcoin, or P.O. Box. Our sincere thanks to all of you who have stood with us to get this far. Please don't forget to share the links and pray for the country as well as our family.
Please get out. Get out of this property. Immediately get out. Get out of this property immediately. Out. I don't want to hear anything. Out of this property immediately. I don't want to hear a word. Out. Out. Out of this property immediately until you come back with a warrant. Out. 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 Out of this property. Immediately out. Immediately go out and don't come back. Don't, I don't want to talk to you. Not a word. Out of this property. Immediately out. I don't care what you have to say. Out. Out. Out of this property, you Nazis. Out. Out. Gestapo is not allowed here. Immediately, Gestapo is not allowed. Out. Do you understand English? Get out of this property. Go. So go. Go. And don't come back without the warrant. Out, Nazi. Out. Out. You understand? Nazis are not welcome here. Out. And don't come back without a warrant. Do not come back without a warrant. You understand that? You're not welcome here. Nazis are not welcome here. Gestapo is not welcome here. Do not come back, you Nazi psychopaths. Unbelievable, sick, evil people. intimidating people in a church during the Passover. You Gestapo, Nazi, communists, fascists. Don't you dare coming back here. Can you imagine those psychopaths? Passover, the holiest Christian festival in a year, and they're coming to intimidate Christians during the holiest festival? Unbelievable. What is wrong with those sick psychopaths? It's beyond me.
All right, and that was Arthur Pulaski, that viral video, and I think that did all of us good to see that, because so many of us have wanted to say that, but there's not too many people who have the courage of our guest, Arthur Pulaski. The National Post in Canada called him, quote, the symbol of free speech. He has a street church ministry where he helps the homeless in the area. And he has other things that he's done in Canada. But I especially wanted to talk to Arthur because he's from Poland. He grew up in Poland. He lived under communism. And as we saw at the very beginning of the turn towards Marxist America a year ago, in Chicago we had Mayor Lori Lightfoot come down very hard on a couple of Romanian churches that were there. And they did everything they could to close them, to block off their parking lots and all this other sort of thing, to put fines against them. But these were Romanian churches. These people had lived under communism. They knew where this was headed from the very beginning, as Arthur does as well. And so they stood hard, just as Arthur has. And so thank you for joining us, Arthur Pulaski.
Thank you very much for having me in.
I want to talk a little bit about your background, what you've seen. You were born in Poland. Tell us a little bit about what you saw growing up there, how long you were there, what it was like to live under communism.
Well, I grew up in a very interesting country. As you remember from the history, Poland has been always attacked from every side, taken by other countries. Polish people had to deal with Ottoman Empire, Islam, Mongolians, Genghis Khan, Russians, Swiss, Germans, you name it. We have been attacked on a regular basis throughout the history. So, of course, I grew up learning about history, about what those other nations always tried to do to my nation. And, of course, the recent history in 1939, the attack of Nazis on Poland and the Soviets. So I grew up hearing the stories. I grew up hearing from my grandparents about the Nazis, about the Gestapo, about the rapes, about murders, concentration camps. And, of course, as a Polish kid, I have been in Auschwitz-Birkenau many times, and to this day, when I'm in Poland, I always try to visit the biggest concentration camp on the planet Earth, Auschwitz-Birkenau, just to remind myself, and I always take visitors, Americans and Canadians with me, just to feel again what happens when you do not put a check into the powers, into the authorities, the politicians. What can happen? We have to remember that Germany during the Nazism was a Protestant nation, just like America and Canada. And those people are white. So we can look at the black gangs, and we can look at the colored people, and we can point a finger at others. But the problem is that we all are sinners. We all have tendency to do terrible things.
Yes.
All have fallen short of the glory of God. So because there is so much talk about racism right now, you know, I want to just say Jesus didn't die for the color of your skin. He died for your soul. We all are guilty. Every single one of us, we have sinned against God and walked away from him. So Germany, hearing about the stories, learning from history, from my grandparents, from older people about what they witnessed, that was a very big thing for me. It was like written in my heart. And of course, growing up behind the Iron Curtain, under the boots of the Soviets, I've seen communism and socialism firsthand. I've seen the depression. I've seen the alcoholism because people had absolutely no hope, no voice. They couldn't do anything. There was nothing in the stores. Everything was done under the table by bribing. People were stealing left and right because, for example, if you needed a bulb in your house for the light, you couldn't just go to the store and buy it. You had to either smuggle it in or steal it from the place that is manufacturing those things and then exchange it for something else. And that's how the whole country was being run. It was run by 50,000 communists, and they ruled over 36 million slaves, Poles, with a very, very heavy hand. Police could come to your house 5 in the morning, could beat you up, torture you, and then you go to court and you think to yourself, finally, I will be vindicated. Finally, justice will prevail. No, courts were corrupted. And even if you had a judge that was a decent judge, he couldn't do anything because he would be tortured, he would be beaten, he would lose his job. Throughout all of this history, we had a constitution just like the United States of America. You know, because of the video right now, I have talked to so many Americans and they always say the same thing. We have the constitution. We have the constitution. Let me just give you a little bit of a warning, if I can. Poland always had a constitution. Poland was the second country on the planet Earth that had implemented constitution just right after the United States of America. Poland was a very unique country that was electing kings. We've elected kings. There was a huge difference between the monarchies around the world. So freedom, constitution is as, you know, as part of Poles. It's like part of Americans. We value our rights. We value our constitution. However, the dictators, the tyrants don't care about your constitution. When they take over your country, constitution doesn't exist because no one dares to uphold your rights. And that's the big warning to what is happening right now, because you may hide behind the constitution and you may say, hey, this is not going to happen to me. Poland is a perfect example that it can happen. Actually, it did happen, and there was no justice. The courts, the police, no one was upholding the constitution. And even though you didn't do anything wrong, you were sentenced, you were tortured, you were beaten, and you couldn't turn to anyone for help. The media were completely controlled by the Communist Party. There was no freedom of press. You couldn't just publish the truth. It was, everything was controlled. Just like today in Russia, there is this famous newspaper called Pravda. Pravda in Russian language means the truth, but there was never, nothing truthful was coming out of that propaganda machinery, just like we see today in the Canadian mainstream media. They're not reporting the news anymore. They are cooking the news.
Yes.
They are manufacturing the news. And that's a huge warning that you don't have free press anymore. You have reporters that should report the story, but they are making the story. They are indoctrinating the public. That's exactly what I have seen growing up under communist dictatorship. Was no truth. Everyone was depressed. People had no rights. The fear, the level of fear, everyone is afraid of everyone because of the snitch line, just like mm-hmm. we see now being implemented in Western democracies.
Right.
Neighbors calling on neighbors.
That's right.
It was hell on earth. It was unbelievable. Polish people, when you visited them, the first thing they would put on the table was a bottle of vodka because everyone was so depressed. Everyone just miserable. The only way to cheer each other up, it was either going to church, which if you were part of the Communist Party was illegal for you. You couldn't do it. And if they caught you and took a picture, oh, you were in a big trouble. And then the people turned into alcohol. You know, that's why so many Polish people became alcoholics.
Mm-hmm.
In 1981, I witnessed something remarkable, and that's what gives me hope that we can do this. 1981, Polish people had enough of dictatorship, enough of slavery, and they took it to the streets, non-compliance, peacefully, millions of Poles end up on the streets, and they said to the communists and to the Russians, we will not work for you anymore. We will not comply. Tens of thousands of Poles were arrested. Some were shot, beaten, tortured, clapped to death. Yes, some had to pay a terrible price for freedom. And it lasted for 2 years, martial law. However, after that uprising called Solidarity, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, Solidarity, like Bawensa,
yeah. mm-hmm.
a big story.
Like Bawensa, yeah.
They took to the streets and they won their freedom. Poland became one of the best democracies on the planet Earth. A few years after that, they've elected their first president after the Second War. So I witnessed those two things. I witnessed the horrible boot of totalitarian government. And I witnessed the power. And again, let me say it again, the power, because we have the power of unified people. When people finally had enough of what they were seeing, there is more of us than of them. Believe me, there is more of us than of them. What we need to do is unite. Polish people were very religious people, and they turned to God first, and they gathered in churches. That's why what I see right now is the biggest attack on the churches. Why? Because when you come together, you exchange information. The government doesn't want that.
Yes.
When you come together, you're strengthened. You have hope. You feel that you're not alone. You can organize. You can organize meetings, rallies, protests. The government doesn't want that. That's why right now what we're seeing, you know, at least in my country here in Canada, is isolation, depression, suicide. You cannot visit your parents. You cannot visit your grandparents. You cannot go and have a coffee with your children. You cannot have anyone in your house. That's illegal. You cannot have churches. That's illegal. You cannot have gatherings. That's illegal. You cannot go to a restaurant because you can talk to other human beings. They want you separated, physical distancing, or social distancing, sometimes they call it. That's the purpose. This is the greatest elimination also of the middle class, small and medium businesses. Why? Because the middle class, you have to remember, the middle class, it's the driving force, and the small and medium businesses of every economy. They're well-traveled, well-educated. They've been places. You cannot fool them about what's going on. They've seen things. They learned about things. And they see that this is the repetition of history. So the government, if government wants to implement totalitarian dictatorship, has to eliminate the middle class, the small and medium-sized businesses, the opposition, if you will. Only in order to turn the people into two categories. And what we are witnessing right now is the greatest slaughter of the middle class in our history. They want two categories of people, extremely rich and powerful. That's why Walmarts are open. That's why Costco are open. That's why IKEAs are open. All those big mega organizations, even though doesn't make sense and doesn't fit the rhetorics, because more people, right, the spread of the virus and this and that, you know, it's more dangerous. But no, what you're seeing is the opposite. You can go to IKEA here in the city of Calgary, and on the door, right on the door, and I did a video about that, it says only 480 people allowed, only. But I cannot have a church. I cannot visit my parents legally because we're super spreaders. But you can go to IKEA with my parents, no problem. And we can mingle around with other people, 500, half a thousand. And that's okay. You can go to Walmart, hundreds of cars, people walking around, touching things. No, that's okay. But I cannot have a coffee with my parents. I cannot spend time with my children.
That's the amazing thing about this. And, you know, this is why I wanted to talk to you, because Rod Dreher, I don't know if you're familiar with his book, Live Not by Lies, but that was what he was saying. He said, I know a lot of people whose parents came here living under communism, and they are scared to death about what is happening here. Everything that you described there, the corruption of the courts, corruption of the press, the police, the fact that we've moved away from the rule of law, that's exactly why he wrote that book and why he referenced Solzhenitsyn, who said, we're not going to live by this lie anymore. Exactly what you pointed out that happened under Lech Walesa in Poland in 1981, that's what has to happen. It'll be that way until the people wake up and say, we've had enough, like Solzhenitsyn and the dissidents there in the Soviet Union, and the people in Poland push back on that. Let's talk a little bit about your experiences there in Canada, because when you came to Canada, just tell people briefly how you got to Canada out of Poland and why you went to Canada. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, my parents, of course, I was still a kid. I was a teenager. I emigrated. We escaped actually from Poland on a boat when I was 17. But my parents, of course, lived under the boot of the Soviets for a longer period of time. And everyone was sick and tired of corruption, sick and tired of not seeing or receiving justice, sick and tired of the propaganda day and night, nonstop, through the television and newspapers. We used to use newspapers for toilet paper. That's what they were only good for, because you could not buy toilet paper anywhere. I mean, this is communism. You can't even go and buy toilet paper because there is none. You had to smuggle it. You had to bribe people. I mean, it was insanity.
And that's where we began our communist experiment with those toilet paper shortages. Exactly.
I know.
The same thing. Yeah.
It was incredible to watch that, because I saw people fighting for toilet paper in the stores, beating each other up. And it reminded me of the childhood, that we were always on the hunt for toilet paper. I know my wife doesn't like when I tell the stories, but I mean, this is the experience of communism and socialism. As crazy thing as a toilet paper was nowhere to be found, you had to chop the newspaper, the propaganda paper, into little squares, and you had to break it up to be, you know, used, because otherwise you would cut yourself. I mean, it's crazy things, and people in America do not understand the concept, because you have never really lived under the boot of a dictator for hundreds of years. So the concept of totalitarian government is a foreign to the new generation. So we were sick and tired of it. The changes were happening, that's true. Democracy was at the horizon. However, at the first years of democracy, mafia took over the entire country. So from one problem to another, and it was chaos. The Communist Party collapsed. The Russians collapsed. They withdrew their soldiers. Everything was collapsing, and mafia people took over the country, just like they did in Russia. That's why Putin, if you know the story of Putin, he was the head of the KGB, and he was tasked with a job to take care of the mafia, because mafia was running the country. What he did, he shot them, he killed the big names, and took over mafia himself. That's why he became the richest man on the planet Earth. Because he took over the dirty business of mafia, prostitution, drugs, alcohol, and then oil. But that's another story. Poland was experiencing the same thing. And we just didn't want to live under another boot. Now it's cleaner. After a few years, they've cleaned the mafia. They combated them, arrested, and all that stuff. But my father decided it's time to go and start fresh, new, no corruption. And we emigrated on the boat. But because we could emigrate, the Communist Party refused our passports. They refused to let us go from the country. So we had to escape on the boat, went to Bucharest, then Istanbul via, you know, Turkey, and then Athens, Greece. And then we started our life all over again in a little town called Agios Apostolios, 50 kilometers from Athens. And we started our business. That's where I met my wife. And then a few years later, the Canadian government invited us to an embassy. And they've told us this: come to Canada. Canada is the greatest country on the planet Earth. No one will be hunting you for your faith. You'll be free. You can bring your business. You can, you know, this is a great country. And we said, let's do it. Let's go to a country that is clean, that we can work hard, that we can achieve something, that we can be truly free. And in 1995, we emigrated to Canada. We started our business again. And then behold, I became a strong Christian. My wife was a Christian when I met her, and she led me to the Lord. And here I am today, reliving my childhood, fighting for my rights. I have been arrested dozens of times. I received hundreds of tickets, including, I call them the COVID tickets, 28 of them so far, and hundreds of other tickets. I stood over 100 times before different courts, from provincial to criminal to QB. I fought with Attorney General, Minister of Justice, number of mayors, number of premiers, and lots of other politicians. And of course, the entire mainstream media. I have been on every television, news talk, newspaper, slandered, called names. For example, they've called me syphilis. The mainstream media called me worse than a syphilis, because you can cure syphilis, but you cannot cure this, the city of Calgary from Arthur Pawlowski. So
you're not going to go away. That's great. I love the fact that you will not go away. And I want to talk about how and why They went from a situation where they called you the symbol of free speech, where they did documentaries about the good work you were doing with the homeless. It was about your Christian beliefs. But tell us the story about how you went from a businessman that was recruited by the Canadian government because they wanted to have people who had the initiative to be entrepreneurs. How did you get from that to the situation where you became a street preacher? There was something that happened with your son. Is that correct?
That's right. So I was a typical businessman. I was drinking. I was a drunkard, actually, but you couldn't tell because I was wearing a Giorgio Armani suit, driving sport cars. I had money. I was making $5,000 a day. I was a developer. I was building houses for the richest people. I had my own magazine. My life was good. I had seven houses. I had properties. I was golfing a lot, you know, eating in the best restaurants. And I was on my way up very quickly. I was considered to be quite successful. I could make millions of dollars a year. And I was a happy guy if it comes to money, but I was a miserable human being. I was depressed. I was a drunkard. I was fighting with my wife all the time. And even though from time to time I would go to church, I was living a life of a devil. And my wife, she was a Christian when I met her in Greece, and she was telling me about Jesus. She was telling me about church from time to time. Because I loved her, I would drive her to church, and I would sit in the back uninterested to listen to the sermons. And that was going on for a number of years, seven to be exact. I call that 7 years of hell with Arthur Pawlowski. I gave her hell, literally. I was so bad. And this woman was crying so much. It's unbelievable the level of hostility that I gave her because she was a Christian. So I was a successful businessman. I was a drunkard. I was bad towards my wife. And then she prayed. And I'm telling you the power of a praying woman. In the Bible, actually, it shows us that every single time a woman prayed, God answered. I have not found a prayer in the Bible done by a woman that God would not answer. He has a soft spot for the weaker vessel, as he calls it, a woman that is under attack from a more powerful physically man. She prayed, she prayed, she talked, and one day she comes home and she's happy, and she was not happy very often because I made sure that she was not happy. I was miserable. I wanted her to be miserable as well. So one day she comes home and she says, and I'm asking her, why are you so happy? And she says, well, because God talked to me. He spoke to me. So, oh, okay. What did he say? Well, he said he's going to beat you up. He's going to spank you so hard, you will not be able to walk. And I'm telling you, a little bit of fear entered my heart because I understood that something is about to happen. But I pushed it aside. I ignored it. And the prophet came to the church. And when I was bad to my wife from time to time, just to make up to her, I would drive her to church. So this guest speaker is coming. And, you know, a prophet of God, I was kind of laughing at some other crazy cuckoo guy is at the church. But let's see what he has to say. Okay, I was sitting in the back. And in the middle of the service, he stops. He points a finger at me. And he says, because you're this and this and this and this, I'm going to take everything away from you. And you will be accused and you will be attacked and you will not know what to do. The only person that will know the truth, what is happening to you, will be your wife. And I laugh at the guy. I said, what a crazy cook. I was just about to sign another contract for apartment building. My company was very successful. I had 40 employees and then sometimes 100 I would hire. I had about 50 job sites. I was doing good, and this guy says I will end up with nothing. I said, he's crazy. Few months, it took God 3 months. I'm sure he could do it a lot faster, but he was merciful. Within 3 months, I was bankrupt. Every job site, something was stolen. Clients stopped paying. I mean, it was a supernatural turn of events. 3 months later, I end up with a borrowed car from my father. I've lost everything. I mean, everything. I was in so much debt that the federal government sent three guys that flew specially for me from Ottawa. And they said, buddy, you're going to jail. Mr. Pawlowski, you're going to jail. for unpaid taxes, for I used the money that was supposed to go to the government to pay the people because I wanted the people to be paid. They have families and mortgages, and I used the government money that I was supposed to give it to them every few months to pay off the people. I couldn't pay the government. It was big amounts of money, and suddenly I'm going to jail. I mean, I was absolutely shocked. So I made a deal with them because, of course, I did not steal the money. So they contacted my lawyer and they find out that what I was saying is the truth. And I begged them. I said, give me 6 months. I'll work day and night and I'll pay you back. And they agreed. They said, you get 6 months and not a day more. Within 6 months, I paid every debt, everything I was owing to the government and privately, and I end up with nothing. So God got my attention. That was the first strike. And then I made peace with my wife. She got pregnant. And then a prophet came again and says, I'm going to give you a perfect gift. And we knew with my wife that this is about the baby that is in her womb. So my son is born on March 28, 2000. I'm kind of skipping because it takes me an hour and a half to tell the story. So I'm going to be faster. I will skip. If you are interested in the story, you can go and watch a documentary that they did it on that. It's called Street Advocate. Street Advocate, and you will be able to see more details. And another one, Father's Vision in English as well. And you can see what happened. There are pictures over there. There is a story why. And the surgeon's reports and stuff like this. So my son is about to be born on March 28, 2000. March 28, that's my birthday. I was born on March 28. God says, I'm going to give you a perfect gift through the mouth of the prophet. He is being born the same day I was born, and we name him Nathaniel. Nathaniel in English language, in Hebrew language, means gift from God. So you've got the prophet saying, I'm going to give you a perfect gift. He is born the same day I was born. And we name, because we believe that that's the name God wants for him, gift from God. And my son is born dead. He is not breathing. I will never forget the eyes of my wife when she saw that the baby is not moving. The baby is not crying. The fear in her eyes, I'll never forget. She knew there's something terribly wrong. Then craziness started, doctors, nurses, equipment. I don't even remember, but there was such a commotion with so many equipment things running around. And they managed, after a long time, the boy was completely purple, was not moving at all, a dead, not moving, not breathing. And it looked like he was not breathing for a long time because his color completely changed into purple. And that's what they said afterwards. They said that that was the first miracle that happened because this boy was born dead and he should not be revived. But suddenly he starts breathing again and they couldn't figure it out. They couldn't believe what was happening. It turned out that my son had a hole in his muscle. And through that hole, the bowels went up and smashed his upper chest. Whoa. Everything was messed up. The heart was pushed. It was a big mess. And then the three doctors came to me and they said, the damage is so severe, he doesn't stand a chance. You should consider unplugging him from the machinery. My wife said no. She started to call everyone, the pastor, the church, everyone she knew to pray. I went into a rebellion. I started to accuse God. Why me? Why me? Why me? What do you want from me? You're a psychopath. Choose somebody else. What are you doing? You know, the typical blame shifting. And I blame God for my misfortune. I said, you're a liar. You told me you're going to give me a perfect gift. Look at him. Is this a perfect gift? You are just a lying God. You think this is funny. And, you know, I was kicking the car and I was so furious that when I went to the parking lot and the people saw me, I was kicking and punching the car. And they ran away because they thought I'm crazy. And that took, that was going on for about a few days. And my wife would stay with the kid 24 hours and I would go to work. I would come back and then we would exchange. She would go home, change, shower, something to eat and would come back to to the hospital. And at one of those instances, I was standing there watching my son, a little tiny baby. They could not even find another vein. Every vein that this kid had was taken by some needles, by some crazy things attached to a big, huge equipment. And they said, you know, we run out of veins in this body. We don't know if something happens, if a vein collapses or is there infection, then we don't know what to do. We took all of the veins that are available for the equipment. I mean, it was a horrible, horrible situation. And the kid could not breathe on his own. Machinery was breathing for him. The damage was so severe that the surgeon, when he opened him, she opened him up, she says, I cannot even find a trace, not even a trace of a lung. And they sew him back together and there was nothing they can do. So that's the part of the medical. Now the part of me and God, I'm standing there. My wife went to change and eat something. And I'm looking at this baby in this sterile, white, purified room in intensive care in the city of Calgary. And something happened that I would never believe. A movie, if you will. I don't know how to even describe that. Suddenly, I was taken to another place. And I saw something that at first I did not understand. I saw Jesus Christ in Gethsemane. And I saw him being terrified, sweating with blood. And I saw a mob of people, over 1,000 people, coming, filled with rage, hate. It's like it was like a mob of wolves coming to tear flesh to pieces. And they came to arrest him. And then I saw, and I was there. No one could see me, but I was there seeing everything that was unfolding. I saw when they asked him, you know, where is Jesus? He says, I am. And I saw the power hit them. They end up on the ground. And then when they tried to stand up, I saw them all on their knees, like bowing before Jesus, unintentionally, of course. And it showed me that in the end, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess, either they like it or not, that Jesus is the Lord. I saw the beatings and pushing started already in Gethsemane when they arrested him. I saw this young boy being taken by this mob. And they wanted just blood. They were thirsty, demon-possessed for blood. And they stripped him naked, and he runs for his life naked. They took him to the Sanhedrin. It was still a night hour. They took him there. I saw people beating him up. I saw punches with fists, slapping. I saw people beating him with that side of the hand. And like a woman beats, and the punches coming, blood everywhere. It was a horrible, horrible thing. It, like every time they punched him and laughed at him and spat at him, like it was preying on me. I couldn't take it. I saw this young man in his 30s with a beard. He looked like a priest, you know, from Sanhedrin. He runs towards Jesus, filled with hate, grabs Jesus's beard with such a force, with such an impact and power, that rips portion of his beard out of Jesus' face. The beard with the skin and the blood splashed all over. I couldn't take it. I walked out of the intensive care and I started to run so the vision would stop. And I didn't stop running until I was outside and the vision stopped. I was so horrified. It was the most horrible thing I've ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. And the next day came, and it's the same situation. I go home, I shower, I eat something, I go to a hospital to change my wife so she can do the same thing. And then I stand in the same place, and boom, the vision starts again. And I see continuation of the mocking and beating. I saw a conversation, and I've heard a conversation with Pontius Pilate when they were talking about, and Pontius Pilate, the governor, the Roman governor, was very, very interested in Jesus, hearing him speak. He've heard about Jesus. He was really curious about that man. Then I saw the beatings, the soldiers, the mockery, the lashes. It was so horrible. I ran from the hospital for the second time. Then I calmed down. I went back in for the third time, and boom, division starts again where it ended. So I realize that God is not going to get me off the hook, that I have to watch this whole thing to the end. And I stood over there and I watched him being crucified. I watched him, the whole thing, the most horrible thing you can imagine, the most horrible way to die. When he died, I saw darkness like you cannot understand. It was not a darkness that we are accustomed to. It was a supernatural darkness. Everywhere you looked, it was dark. And then I saw nature. I saw a little bird, and it was a close-up with his beak, and I saw his eyes, and he was crying. A bird was crying. Then I saw a piece of grass, and the grass was crying. It's like God wanted me to see that creation was crying because the Creator paid the ultimate price for the creation to redeem it. And then it was over. I saw an earthquake. It was a global earthquake. It was not just a local earthquake. It looked like the whole earth broke in half. And then it was over. And I didn't hear anything. It was like a pause. And then I heard a voice like I'm hearing you right now. And this is what the voice said to me. What would you do to save your son? And I said right away without hesitation, tell me to kill and I will kill. I'll wipe out half of this hospital if needs be so my son can live. And then he continued, but you cannot save your son, but I could save my son. And I didn't do it. You know why? For you and for the rest of the people. At that moment, I was so broken, I realized how horrible of a man I was. Horrible. I would take your son and kill. I would take somebody's daughter, somebody's father, somebody's mother, just so I can escape pain. I would cause you pain. I realized that in order for me to have something, I would cause you pain. But God, in another hand, he could do it another way, but he's chosen to suffer for me, for this horrible, evil person that I was. I saw two hearts of fathers. One father was slimy, dirty, like a tar, black heart. That was my heart. And then I saw a heart of a pure father. The heart looked like a crystal. You could see through. It was incredible thing, pure, holy, beautiful. And that father was willing to suffer for me. If I can describe it, I don't even know how to describe this to you. My heart was broken. I was completely changed. I was broken. My wife, because I didn't realize at that time, I was so shocked. I was traumatized by everything I saw. She said I could not talk for 3 days. I don't even remember that part. So at that night after the final vision, we went to church because pastor was doing a prayer session for my son and for us. So first time since my son was born, I went to the church and I stood in the back. I don't even know what they're saying. I didn't pay attention to the people. I just lifted my hands high. And I said this to God. I said, God, I'm giving you my son like Abraham, Isaac on the altar. Do with him as you please. But if you will choose to save him, if you will choose to heal him, I will be grateful for the rest of my life. And I started to cry like never before. And the tears were coming out. As every tear was coming out, I literally saw that the tears were representing sins that I have committed. The things I have done, the smuggling, the business, the bribes, the money, the beatings, the alcoholism, all of those things, every tear was representing a sin that I have done against God and against people. And I started to cry loudly, weep. And I ran out of tears. I don't know how long it took. I've lost the track of time. I don't know how long this was going on. When this was over and I had no more tears, I said to God, God, no matter what you're going to choose, if you will choose to take my son home, fine with me. But I pray, I beg you, let it be now so we don't have to suffer anymore. So my wife doesn't have to suffer anymore. If he is to die, let it be now. But if you will choose to heal him, like I said before, I'll be grateful to you for the rest of my life. But nevertheless, I'm giving you my oath right now. I'm giving you my oath that no matter what you're going to do, I'm going to serve you and only you for the rest of my life. And nothing happened. Nothing happened. The earthquake didn't come. The shaking didn't come. The fire didn't come from heaven. We went home, and the next day, exactly the same scenario. I go to work. I come back to the hospital. And then behold, as I'm walking, people are pointing a finger at me and saying, that's the father. That, look, that's the father. That's the father of the star baby. That's him. That's him. And I didn't know what happened. No one notified me. No one called me. As I reached the intensive care, I was expecting not to see my son. I was expecting that he's going to die. And he already died. And the same three doctors came to me and they said, you got to come with us. Something happened. We have to explain it to you. They took me to the x-ray room and they said, look at the pictures. And they had number of pictures over there. You see this? That's the bowel. And the bowel smashed everything and messed the whole thing. But look at the next one. You see that little tiny thing? That's your son's lung. It was not there, but now it's appearing. So we started to take a picture every hour. And behold, the lung is appearing. It was not there, but it's there right now. And your son is breathing on his own. We thought there is a malfunction of the equipment. So we took the tube out of him and he's breathing. That's impossible. And they look at me like I don't understand what they're saying. They said, listen, your son cannot breathe. But he's breathing. He should not be alive, but he's alive. It's like a baby that came from the stars. So we called the symposium of doctors and we talked about your son all day. And we came to one conclusion. There's no medical explanation. Why he is alive? It looks like the baby came from the stars and God heard your prayers. My son right now is 21 years old. He is in university. He's perfectly healthy. He doesn't even have one allergy. So from that moment, it still took me a few years. I went back to business. I went back to business God's way. So I was not bribing the police. I was not bribing the politicians. I did it clean. Everything was according to the Bible. I was the number one giver in the church. I was giving money for the homeless and events and this and that equipment. So I was generous. I changed my life. I stopped drinking completely. No drugs, no drinking, nothing. And I had a fancy office in Bankers Hall in the city of Calgary. And I remember sitting over there and my life was good. I was with God and God was blessing me. I taught, money was flowing. It was a good, good time. And then I hear the voice, the same voice that I've heard 5 years before that told me, what would I do to save my son? The same God, the same voice speaks to me and says this. Pack your stuff from your office and go out in your underwear. In Polish, in your underwear means leave everything behind. And he says, and do not look back at Egypt. And I was shaken. I was shocked. So I packed my stuff. I walked out of my office and I never went back to business. I've lost millions of dollars. I've lost my houses. I've lost my properties. And I was never more happy than I am right now. I started to work with the homeless full time. I organized an organization that is called worldwide right now, March for Jesus. We are marching on the streets of different cities on different continents. And I also started an organization that is now 40 chapters around the world called Street Church. Street Church, which is a church for the homeless, for the poor, in ghettos, on the streets where we feed the people and we worship God, we preach the gospel, we share testimonies.
That's wonderful. Yeah, and you know, Lee Strobel did a book recently, Miracles, and he talks about how doctors, and when they poll doctors by a large margin, they believe more in miracles than the general population because they've seen things like that, like you described. That's an amazing testimony. If you got it just a few more minutes, Arthur, I'd like to talk about your work with the homeless because, you know, we got a lot of people who are looking at what has happened in the last year. A lot of people have been hurt. As you pointed out, it's a targeting of the middle class to destroy the middle class. Marxists always do that. They always focus on the bourgeois, the middle class. They hate that. They don't want that. But a lot of people are looking at radical changes that have happened in their life, radical changes that are going to be coming up. You've ministered to the homeless. You've ministered to people who've already lost everything. In many cases, they're addicted to drugs. They're hopeless. They're in worse situation than a lot of the people who've been locked down this year. What do you tell the homeless? What do you tell the people that are fearful about what is coming in the future? What's your message of hope?
Well, the message is still the same. Jesus sits on the throne no matter what the tyrants are doing.
Yes.
He holds their lives in the palm of his hands. So like I say quite often, my enemies are only alive because my Father allows them to be alive for whatever reason. Sometimes I do not understand God's reasoning, but I don't have to. I'm not God. I know that my life is in the palm of his hands. What do I say to the homeless people? I say that they have a choice like everybody else. Every man has a choice, and God is such an amazing God that he left us with that choice. You can choose him, and you can be free, and he's going to work with you, and he's going to change your circumstances because he is a loving God. That's why he came and died on the cross. He didn't say, I care for you, I love you, and then he left you in sin. He did something. He's God that does things, not just talk. Talk is cheap. He paid with his own blood. It cost the Father his Son. It cost the Son his own life for you and for me. So I say to the people that they have a choice. They can choose Jesus or they can keep marching on in the path of destruction. That's the choice. Let the wicked continue in their wickedness. Let the righteous continue in the righteousness. If it comes to the situation that we see right now, I believe that out of this, an amazing thing is going to happen because this is the greatest separation we have ever seen during our lifetime. The sheep are being separated from the goats. The sheep are being separated from the wolves. Now we see more and more who is the real Christian, follower of Jesus Christ, and who is fake, who is the real pastor that is willing to pay the price, who is willing to stand up and fight with the enemy. And I'm not talking about guns and swords. Just stand up, a good shepherd. He has a staff and a stick in his hands for the purpose of defending people that, the sheep that are entrusted to him, to fend off the wolves. And that's what I do. That's what the video that you've seen around the world, I've heard that over 1 billion people watch that video around the world. The number one played video at that time on the planet Earth. What did I do? I just did what I believe every leader should be doing, fending off enemies, fending off the evil. Standing up for the truth and saying to the wicked, get out. You're not welcome here. Get out. We need to stand up and fight because God is for us. The message for the people that are losing hope is this: greater is he that is in us than the one that is in those villains. The message is unchangeable. God is for you, not against you. And even if the whole hell goes and fights you, you got to remember God is stronger. You and God, me and God, we are always the majority. Even if the whole earth goes crazy, if God is for me, who can be against me? And the hell and the gates of hell shall not prevail against God's church. Those are the promises that we have. 365 times a year, God says, do not fear. Fear not. Fear not. Why is he telling us this? Mm-hmm. Because he knows that when you are living, with him, when you're aligned with his will, he is going to come through. And if you die, Esther said, if I perish, I perish. That's okay. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, well, if he is not going to rescue, so be it. But we will not bow before the golden idol. Daniel breaks the law, opens the windows, and prays because God is more important for him than the law of man. And this is the message that we have to keep preaching. The book of Acts message, which is the book of action, chapter 4, they said, judge ye for yourself whom we are to obey, you, man, sinner, or God. Chapter 5 is more straightforward. We must obey God rather than men. That's my message. Fear not, because God is on your side. If you're doing something for his kingdom, he's going to come true. And do not be afraid of viruses and diseases. Our job is to lay hands on the sick. then they will recover. Our job is to anoint them with oil and pray. God's job, not our job, is to heal people. If he chooses not to, so be it. He's God. He knows better. But I've seen many, many, many thousands of people being healed, even right now during this whole fiasco of the so-called pandemia. I've had people coming to our church broken with all kinds of sicknesses. And I would pray for them, and they would come back and say, I got healed. I got healed. That's the power that God wants to give his church. But there is a catch. If you're in rebellion, if you are rebelling against the will of God, which is go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to all creation, if you're doing this for your own ambition, your own career, if you're building your denomination instead of God's kingdom, you will not have that kind of power. Mm-hmm. And the enemy will walk on you. If the salt loses its saltiness, will be useless. And let me just remind you what the governments said about the church. They've called us non-essential. They've called us non-essential. Why? Because the salt lost its saltiness. And the people look at us and they say, we don't need you. We don't want you because you're useless. You're hypocritical. You're doing this just for the money. So salt needs to be salty again. And the light needs to shine everywhere. When you do that, nothing will be impossible for you. If you don't, it says, the verse continues, if the salt loses its saltiness, will be useless and trampled by men.
Yes.
That's the choice we have right now as the church. We got to do what God commands us to do. When we do it, God shows up.
That's right. And it is never too late. Every day we have another opportunity to make that decision. Wonderful testimony. Thank you for sharing that with us. I want to get you on sometime and talk a little bit more about what's going on and the kinds of persecution that you've had there before this began. But thank you for your faithfulness and your steadfastness. Thank you, Arthur Pawlowski. It was wonderful talking to you. That's it for our program. Thanks for staying with us. I know we've gone over time, but I imagine you probably enjoyed listening to this as much as I did. Thank you very much.
Has your news been censored, banned over and over again? Has vital information been held prisoner by mainstream and anti-social media? It's the duty of every thinking person to make the great escape to thedavidknightshow.com. There you'll find links to live streams, videos, audio podcasts, and support links. Live stream the show at DLive and Trovo every Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern. Videos at BitChute and YouTube. New audio podcast, The Real David Knight Show, at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, iHeart, Spotify, and more. But even though there's a light at the end of the tunnel, without your support, the show will run out of gas. The links to support the show are at thedavidknightshow.com. To donate via Subscribestar, donate via PayPal, or donate via Venmo, Cash App, Bitcoin, or P.O. Box. Our sincere thanks to all of you who have stood with us to get this far. Please don't forget to share the links and pray for the country as well as our family.